isolation, fatigue, as well as stigma and shame.
Doctors in particular face unique barriers to seeking treatment and support for their mental health.
Medical Emergency on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Tonight at 8.
This is BBC Radio 4. Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 1st of September. This is Today with Johnny Diamond in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
The headlines today, Andy Burnham is to make his first common statement as Prime Minister, with questions looming about prison places and the cost of living. We'll speak to the Justice Secretary after eight. A former gang boss has been found guilty of ordering the murder of the rapper Tupac Shakur, the first conviction in a case that has captivated hip-hop fans for decades.
30 years ago, this month, rapper Tupac Shakur was murdered in Las Vegas. And today is a day we find the person responsible for that.
Also in today's programme, as Lionel Messi quits international football and questions are asked about how much longer Novak Djokovic can go on, when is the best time for athletes to call it a day?
I don't think any athlete really knows when is exactly the right time to retire. It's very hard because it's like a rock star that doesn't want to get off the stage.
Annabelle Croft and the former lioness Ellen White will give us their thoughts. And Freddie Mercury's best friend, Mary Austin, who he nearly married, speaks about their complicated relationship, including whether this hit was about her.
Love of my life, you've hurt me.
I think not. But I do recognise the end of the song.
I will be there at your side to remind you how I still love you.
The BBC News is read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
Andy Burnham is preparing for his first parliamentary appearance as Prime Minister, where he's expected to tell MPs he wants to create a sense of optimism in Britain. Mr Burnham is scheduled to meet his cabinet this morning before heading to the House of Commons to face questions. The Conservatives and Reform UK are expected to demand more details about how the Prime Minister will pay for the policies he's announced so far. Our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, reports.
Andy Burnham has been in office for 6 weeks now, but we've never seen him in Parliament as Prime Minister. In fact, it's 16 years since he's appeared in the Commons as a minister. In his first outing today, Mr Burnham will seek to describe the broad direction his government will take, focusing in particular on two areas. He will talk about his desire to secure stronger public control of essential services, and he will offer more detail on Number 10 North, explaining how he hopes it will fundamentally reshape how the country is run. Perhaps the biggest difference that the Prime Minister hopes to establish with what came before is tonal. He will promise a sense of optimism about Britain's future, saying that his programme for government will unlock a feeling of positivity and possibility in every part of the country.
The government says it will invest £110 million in building hundreds of new prison places in existing jails in England and Wales. The plans include the conversion of unused spaces into cells. Our senior UK correspondent, Seema Katecha, has more details.
This money comes from the Ministry of Justice's existing budget, so the cash isn't new, but the initiative is. The government says the £110 million will now be used to accelerate the construction of hundreds of prison places over the next couple of years. It says all of the money will be spent on converting existing spaces in prisons, such as unused laundry rooms and storage areas, into cells. But prison governors say they're already lacking staff, and the plan means they'll require more prison officers to manage the additional offenders and keep them safe.
A former gang leader has become the first man to be convicted over the murder of the rapper Tupac Shakur, who was shot dead in Las Vegas in 1996. Dwayne Davis, who's now 63, had denied ordering the killing. After 30 years of mystery, the jury took just 3 hours to return their verdict. Our correspondent Shaima Khalil sent this report.
Count one, murder with use of a deadly weapon. Guilty of first-degree murder with use of a deadly weapon.
Dwayne Davis showed no reaction as the guilty verdict was announced. The 63-year-old sat with a neutral expression before being led from the courtroom by officers. For more than 2 weeks, jurors heard from former gang associates, eyewitnesses, and police detectives about Tupac's killing and what led to it. The jurors took less than 3 hours to convict him of first-degree murder. Prosecutors said he supplied the gun and repeatedly admitted his involvement in interviews and a memoir. His lawyer had argued those accounts were fiction, told for fame and money, and said there was no physical evidence placing Davis at the scene. But the jury rejected that defence.
The 23-year-old man has been charged with two counts of murder in connection with a fire at a house near Middlesbrough last Wednesday. 7-year-old Valentina Foster and her 34-year-old aunt, Natalie McDonald, died in the blaze in Grangetown. Four others were injured. Cleveland police said the man had also been charged with grievous bodily harm with intent. The Home Office says the number of migrants who have crossed the Channel in small boats this summer has fallen to a six-year low. It said joint action with the French authorities had helped achieve the improvement, but the Conservatives say the fall is down to bad weather. Simon Jones reports.
Between the start of June and the end of August, almost 7,500 migrants reached the UK in small boats. That's the lowest figure for the summer months since 2020. The government said its efforts to target the criminal gangs behind the crossings were delivering results, with British money funding more police officers on the beaches of northern France to prevent small boats from launching. The Conservatives, though, said the government's strategy was simply to pray for choppy seas, insisting bad weather had played a large part in the numbers falling.
Nepal's Prime Minister has said last week's devastating flash floods weren't an ordinary event, but were driven by climate change. More than 900 people are now known to have been killed in Nepal, with nearly 4,000 missing. A trade pact with nations around the Pacific has come into effect for British firms, giving them full access to 600 million potential new customers. The CPTPP was hailed as the biggest trade deal since Brexit, when the UK first signed up 3 years ago. Its members include Canada, Australia and Vietnam. Here's our business correspondent, Megan Owen.
The UK signed up to the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership in 2023. Since then, other members have been approving the UK's membership, with Canada the last to do so. One of the benefits is that people working for British companies operating in Canada can now stay there for up to 6 months, rather than 90 days in any 6 months. The Chancellor, John Healey, says full access to the trading bloc will help British companies boost exports and drive growth and job creation.
The Met Office will publish provisional figures this afternoon, which are expected to show that this summer was the UK's hottest since records began in 1884. That would break a benchmark set just last year. BBC Weather's Ben Rich explains.
It's been a summer of heat waves, drought and wildfires that has already broken records. Temperatures have reached or exceeded 30 Celsius somewhere in the UK on 40 days this year. The previous record was 34 days. An unprecedented four calendar months saw highs above 35 Celsius. Persistent areas of high pressure left some parts of southern England without rain for 2 months in the middle of the summer. However, wet weather at the start and end of the season in some areas means UK records for dryness are unlikely to be broken for the summer overall.
Ben Rich reporting.
Thanks very much, Caroline. It's 7 minutes past six. Let's find out what today's weather will bring with Helen Willetts at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Helen.
Good morning, Johnny. Hello there. Good morning. It's Atlantic-driven weather today for the northern half of the UK, in particular, ridge of high pressure further south. So again, we'll see temperatures into the low, pushing the mid-20s for England and Wales, where I'll start the detail. Plenty of sunshine, first thing. There are one or two showers around the borders into Cumbria at the moment, one or two through the Bristol Channel, just brushing into the South Wales coast. But by and large, plenty of sunshine. The cloud bubbles up through the day. It should stay dry. It should stay bright with some sunshine. But there will be a scattering of showers come this afternoon. That said, they won't be as intense or as widespread as recent days. The wind's not as strong and quite a few places could stay dry with temperatures between 20 and 23 degrees Celsius quite widely. For Northern Ireland, it's a different story. We've got that weather front approaching. So we do have some patchy rain already in the north and west, quite a bit of cloud, but there is a little sunshine in the east to start. The cloud will tend to fill in, though, as that weather front just edges its way southwards and eastwards through the day. Temperatures around 17 or 18, a bit of a breeze picking up. But of course, it's the first day of the meteorological autumn, so nothing exceptional, really. And for Scotland as well, yes, the breeze is going to pick up. It's pushing the rain in through this morning, all parts seeing that rain push southwards and eastwards. And then it becomes stuck across the central belt and the southern uplands as well into the afternoon. But it brightens up further north. Some sunshine, just a scattering of showers here. 15 to 18, the highs today, and that rain just hangs around then through tonight and into tomorrow.
Thank you very much indeed, Helen. It is 9 minutes past six now. Let's take a first look at the front pages of the morning papers, a number of which look forward to Andy Burnham's first parliamentary appearance as Prime Minister later on in the Commons. The Guardian says his statement to MPs will drive home his pledge to bring more essential services back into public control. The paper's spoken to a Downing Street source who says Mr Burnham's statement will be all about proving that he can bring back hope. The Sun says this marks the end of the Prime Minister's honeymoon and says that now he will have to deliver on Britain's real problems of welfare, a flatlining economy and defence.
Some hints on the government's plans for that last issue are in The Times, where the Chancellor John Healey says he'll set out a clear path to spending 3% of national income on defence in the spring. But he has warned that will mean difficult decisions in the budget this autumn.
Kemi Badenoch's shake-up of her Conservative shadow cabinet over the bank holiday weekend is hailed as a ruthless reshuffle by the Daily Mail, which says she's getting the Tories ready for battle amid rumours of an early election. The Financial Times believes Ms Badenoch's first goal should be to restore the Conservatives to their traditional position as the country's major right-wing party.
The Daily Express highlights a report backed by the former Defence Minister Al Carnes, which urges the government to drop its Northern Ireland Troubles Bill over fears it could trap soldiers in endless legal jeopardy. Mr Carnes is quoted as warning that justice is not served when the process itself becomes the punishment. Ministers say the existing Legacy Act protects terrorists and leaves victims, veterans exposed, while their plans will fix a broken system.
The Daily Mirror this morning says that Ghislaine Maxwell is preparing to beg, in its words, President Trump for her freedom. The paper believes it's her last hope to end her 20-year prison sentence that she's serving for procuring girls for Jeffrey Epstein.
Cancer patients receiving immunotherapy could survive for twice as long if they receive their treatment in the morning rather than the afternoon, according to research picked up by the Daily Telegraph. It says doctors at the Christie Hospital in Manchester found it made the biggest difference for people with skin and lung cancer. We'll speak to the professor behind the study before 7 o'clock.
We will. It's 11 minutes past six now. Some news overnight, which hasn't made the morning papers after almost 30 years. You'll remember the rapper Tupac Shakur was shot dead in Las Vegas. Well, finally, a man has been found guilty of his murder. This is the moment that the verdict was read out in a packed courtroom.
The verdict reads as follows. We, the jury in the above entitled case, find the defendant Dwayne Keith Davis as follows. Count one, murder with use of a deadly weapon. Guilty of first degree murder with use of a deadly weapon, dated this 31st day of August 2026. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is this your verdict as read? So say you one, so say you all.
Yes.
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 Well, Anushka Matanda-Doherty is a presenter of the podcast Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial. She's been in Las Vegas following the trial and joins us now. Anushka, before we talk about this man who's finally been found guilty, just remind us a bit about this case and the fact that it's taken so long to get to this point.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a case full of twists and turns and lots of people's different conspiracy theories. But ultimately, the theory from the prosecution, which has been found to be true today by the jury, is that on the 7th of September 1996, in Las Vegas, Tupac was shot when a white Cadillac pulled up next to the car he was in and opened fire after he and Suge Knight had attacked a 20-year-old boy at the MGM casino, who was actually the nephew of the defendant. Now, Dwayne Davis, who's been found guilty, isn't actually accused of firing the gun, but of being the shot caller and the architect of the crime. So he called the shot and literally told them to fire the gun that took Tupac's life. And it's taken a really long time for him to be able to sit in front of a courtroom and be prosecuted because he entered into a lot of different agreements with law enforcement over the different years to do with different crimes that he was being investigated for. But after he published a book in 2019 where he basically admitted to all of this, it was open season and fair game for them to prosecute him for his crime. That's why we're here in 2026 today.
Yeah, tell us a bit more about him. Was he well known in that world at the time?
Yeah, so if you take the prosecution at their word, which of course the jury have found to be true, he was a shot caller in the Southside Compton Cribs, one of the most notorious gangs in Los Angeles. And they said, and they testified to during the trial, he was as high up as it gets. He was moving so much weight, as in moving so much narcotics, that he couldn't even be gone after by the Compton Police Department or the LA Sheriff's Office. We're talking FBI, LAPD level of criminality here. And they were saying, essentially, his word was law. within this world of gang culture. And if he asked for something to happen, if he decided that Tupac and Suge Knight needed to be retaliated against, that was exactly what was going to happen. It didn't get any higher up. That's what their experts testified to.
Anushka, thanks for joining us this morning. Anushka Mutanda-Doherty, the presenter of that podcast, Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial.
It's 14 minutes past six, and Chinese and Nepalese military personnel are battling to rescue some of the estimated 600 workers trapped in tunnels in Nepal following the glacier collapse that's so far killed at least 939 people. Laura Bickers, our China correspondent in Beijing, keeping an eye on things from there. Laura, can you bring us up to date on what's been happening in both Nepal and China?
Well, in Nepal, as you said, there are those 600 workers believed to be trapped in these vast networks of mud-filled tunnels. Now, over the weekend, they managed to get through the debris. They've managed to put a funnel in there to try to get some air. In one tunnel, they even managed to get rescuers inside, but they had to withdraw after finding no one there. And remember, there are more than 3,900 people missing. 592 of them are foreigners. These tunnels are becoming a focal point because they are trying desperately to get to a number, hundreds of them, that are thought to be stuck in there. But of course, as each day goes by, the hope is lost. Meanwhile, when it comes to this side of the border here in China, they've held a memorial service near the epicentre of the disaster here. That is Girong Port, this land border between Nepal and Tibet. Rescuers took a moment to remember those lost because it's day seven here, and that is the protocol. But rescuers are continuing to wade through waist-high mud and try to find survivors. Now, they've done two sweeps of the area. They're on their third sweep, we understand, from Chinese state media. And what they've told us is so far they've found no survivors.
Laura, over the days we've been speaking, you've mentioned how difficult it has been to get information from the Chinese side of this disaster. Can you give us an idea of how tight the squeeze is on information?
Everything we have comes from Chinese state media. So that is the only way we get any information. We have asked to go to the site in Tibet, and we've been told that one, it's too dangerous, and two, it does need a government permit. In fact, all access to Tibet is highly restricted. And when it comes to information getting out of Tibet, remember they've even censored, Chinese state media has censored the worst of the footage. This was the footage of that wall of water hitting the port. It has not been shown here on television screens, although it did manage to circulate on some social media platforms. But it gives you an idea that Chinese censors are cracking down on any information coming out of the region.
Laura Bicker in Beijing, thank you.
17 minutes past six now. After years of trying to go public in New York and London, the fast fashion giant Shein has finally made it onto the stock market in Hong Kong. But investors haven't given it the warmest of welcome. Shares are down by 8% already. Leanna Burns here with more on that and the rest of the day's business news as well. Morning, Leanna.
Morning, Anna, and morning, Johnny. That is right. It's a lackluster debut for the company. And it's quite the change because at its peak in 2022, Shein was valued at nearly $100 billion. And its flotation values at $26.5 billion, so that's roughly a quarter of that. Victoria Scholar is Head of Investment at Interactive Investor and joins me now. Good morning, Victoria.
Morning.
So, Victoria, shares have fallen pretty sharply on day one. So what does that tell us about how investors are now seeing Shein?
Well, I think that the mood music has really soured in recent years with respect to Shein. It was once seen as this fast growth tech company, but growth has slowed and the macro backdrop has also become a lot more challenging. It reported pretty disappointing results recently, and it's facing stiff competition from retailers like Temu. And it's also suffered with the loss of this key tax loophole, which undermines its low price business model. So there's a lot of headwinds to contend with. And even though valuation had already, or predicted valuation had already dropped quite significantly, we've still seen that shares are down in Hong Kong today. So not the best signal for investors.
Let's talk about that key tax loophole, particularly that was the end of the US de minimis import exemption, also in Europe, led to higher costs. Why did that happen?
Well, previously, in the US, you could import tax-free into the US for packages under $800. And Trump removed that loophole, which has meant that Shein now faces higher costs. And so its whole business model is geared around low-value packages and imports into major economies like the US and Europe. So that's really thrown a major spanner in the works.
Just quickly, the price of barrel of Brent crude, that's the global benchmark for oil, is hovering around $91 per barrel this morning. That's because rising US-Iran tensions are stoking worries about inflation. That's a problem for bonds too, isn't it, Victoria?
Yes, you're right. It's having implications across global markets at a time when the bond market has already seen significant volatility in August. And the Iran war is now entering its sixth month. And we've seen that Brent crude has fallen sharply from those 2026 highs, but it's still up by about 25% since the start of the conflict in February. So that geopolitical risk premium is still very much priced into markets.
OK, Victoria Scholar, Head of Investment at Interactive Investor. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, the UK gets full access to a major international trade agreement from today. It's called the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, the CPTPP for short. And it's a trade deal between Britain and 11 other countries, including Japan, Australia, Mexico and Canada. Now, Britain has already been trading under the deal with most of them, but Canada was the final country to approve the UK's membership, and that takes effect today. Ali Renison is Senior Counsel at the consultancy SEC Newgate. She was previously a UK trade advisor. Ali, good morning.
Good morning.
So why did Britain want to be part of the CPTPP?
Well, this was very much initially about the UK's sort of Indo-Pacific trade pivot and tilt. After it left the EU, there was a big push to try and sort of reorient some of its growth opportunities to markets across the world. But now increasingly we're seeing that if you look at the member countries in CPTPP, it's pretty wide and diverse, everything from the sort of South America to the Pacific Rim countries to Asian markets where we're seeing a lot of growth opportunities. And the UK was really sort of the first country to be let in, as it were, under this big sort of cross-regional agreement.
So if Britain was already a member, what actually changes from today?
The big change, I think, from today is that it has access, better access to the Canadian market. So Canada was one of the holdouts in terms of ratifying the UK's accession to this big sort of cross-regional bloc. You may recall that the UK and Canada actually sort of had to terminate or suspend trade negotiations on bilateral talks a couple of years ago. This actually gives them better access now, particularly in some sectors like beef and dairy, to some of those markets. And also, if you're a business investor, you get to sort of go into Canada for up to 6 months now instead of 90 days. For business purposes.
No, let's talk about that. Maybe a practical example, that example you used, beef. What would businesses that are in beef, what would they be able to export now that they weren't before?
It's about the quota size. So under CPTPP, the Canadian, Canada has offered certain sort of increased quota sizes for ostensibly pretty sensitive products in terms of beef and also for dairy. They're big protected markets in Canada. Some of their producers were not happy about the UK acceding to CPTPP because they wanted basically the UK to change some of its rules around the way sort of beef is treated with hormones, regulatory issues. And so now the UK gets better access in terms of the quota size to the Canadian market.
So the government says the deal could eventually add around £2 billion a year to the UK economy. But Ali, is that actually really just quite a modest economic boost? Because £2 billion sounds like a lot, but actually in the scheme of the UK economy, it isn't really.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in terms of the overall macro numbers, it's a sort of certainly a dent rather than a huge sort of increase in UK GDP. But I think particularly at a time where you're seeing trade barriers rising and protectionism across the world, this sort of helps lock in and increase the UK's sort of footprint, particularly, I think, in growth opportunities into some of these Asian markets. It certainly provides a lot of another option, basically, for UK businesses to trade with many countries that are part of the CPTPP bloc.
So it's really about building Britain's trade links with these countries over the long term rather than just a load of cash straight into the economy.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, if you're looking for supply chain opportunities, this is helping the UK sort of really integrate itself into some of these markets across the world.
All right. Ali Renison, Senior Counsel at the consultancy SEC Newgate, and who was previously a UK trade advisor. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, the US's competition watchdog is suing Amazon over claims it manipulated advertising prices. The Federal Trade Commission, along with 22 states, is alleging the e-commerce giant secretly overcharged more than a million businesses, and some of those extra costs were ultimately passed on to shoppers. In a statement to the BBC, Amazon said it strongly disagrees with the premise that it misled advertisers and called the suit misguided. Bill Kovacic was formerly chair of the FTC, the US's competition watchdog, the Federal Trade Commission, and he's now a professor of law at the George Washington University. Bill, good morning.
Good morning.
So what exactly does the FTC say Amazon was doing, and how would that have resulted in businesses paying more for advertising?
Amazon has claimed to have misled its advertisers about how it goes about calculating the price that will be paid for placing advertising, that it promised them that it would use a formula that tended to reduce the price that advertisers would pay. But in fact, it was surreptitiously increasing that price by using methodologies that would boost the costs that the advertisers would pay. So it's fundamentally a suit that claims misrepresentation and fraud with respect to the terms on which Amazon deals with its advertisers.
Now, Amazon says advertisers were never charged more than the maximum they had agreed to bid, and that its advertising became more effective over this period. How strong of a defense is that, do you think?
It could be a strong defense, because essential to the FTC's claim is that there was misrepresentation and that, in fact, advertisers were misled. And if we go through a trial and the evidence demonstrates, as Amazon claims, that advertisers fully understood what was taking place, so there was no misleading of them, and that the effect of the actual process that was applied was to ensure a lower price paid by advertisers and thus a lower price paid by shoppers, that would be a powerful defense on Amazon's part.
The FTC goes a step further and says shoppers were harmed because businesses passed those higher advertising costs on through their prices. But isn't that much harder to prove?
It involves some pretty tricky accounting to demonstrate exactly what shoppers ultimately paid as a consequence of the practice. And it's an important point, because the emotional and, I think, legal essence of an effective claim is to show a victim. And it's not enough here, I think, just to show that the victims were the advertisers. You want to point to the end buyer as being the true victim here. And without that kind of proof, you don't have an effective case.
Bill, do you think this is a really big case for Amazon? If the FTC wins, what could Amazon actually be forced to change?
They'd be forced to change the way in which they interact with their advertisers. And it is a big case, especially when you take it into combination with two other cases the FTC has brought over the past decade. It's likely by itself to force some changes in the way in which Amazon operates. There's a strong tendency in the past for the large tech companies to make concessions before the case comes to a close. And it also is going to put a lot of information about how Amazon operates into the public domain, information that we don't have now. And to the extent that we go to school on how these companies operate, that tends to have an important impact on the market over time.
And even before we get a verdict, do cases of the scale tend to change the way companies behave anyway?
They do indeed. Companies being aware of the fact of the allegations. In fact, in its answer today, Amazon said, we already made changes that the FTC was pointed to. We were conforming all of our practices to our representations. We had some older training materials that were not consistent with our current policy. The FTC brought these instances to our attention and we changed them. I think we can expect to see that Amazon will carry out further adjustments in its behavior simply as a consequence of the pending of the lawsuit itself.
And could those consequences go beyond America for the way maybe Amazon runs its business advertising here in the UK?
There is an inevitability, I believe, to spillovers that do cross into the borders of other jurisdictions. I think shoppers and advertisers in the United Kingdom can expect to see some benefit from these adjustments that take place well before a trial is concluded.
All right, we'll just have to wait and see. Bill Kovacic, formerly chair of the FTC's US competition watchdog, the Federal Trade Commission, and now professor of law at George Washington University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Liana. It is 28 minutes past six. Jonathan's here with the sports news. So much drama yesterday, Jonathan, with Novak Djokovic crashing out. Can anything rival that?
No. Can I go away now?
No, stick with us, please.
OK. Morning. It was like actually he'd never been away. Seven-time Grand Slam champion Carlos Alcaraz made a winning return to singles tennis last night. Straight sets win over Roman Safelin in the first round of the US Open. The defending champion has been off court, as you may remember, since April with a wrist injury. Correspondent Russell Fuller was watching at Flushing Meadows.
Carlos Alcaraz missed both the French Open and Wimbledon and admits he was more nervous than usual before this first round match. He was wearing a compression sleeve on his right arm but was ripping his forehand and later reported his wrist is currently pain-free. Winning seven best-of-five set matches on his return to tournament play will be extremely challenging, and no man has defended the US Open title since Roger Federer in 2008. But Novak Djokovic and France's top 10 star Arthur Fils have already been removed from Alcaraz's half of the draw, and his chief rival Jannik Sinner is absent with an injured knee.
After so many doubts that he'd be able to make a pain-free comeback, Alcaraz, as you could imagine, was hugely relieved.
Well, I was trying to enjoy as much as I can. Easy to say, difficult to do. And after the match, you know, my body felt great. I'm just really, really happy that I made it finally.
Naomi Osaka and Iga Swiatek also won last night. Two British players enjoyed days to remember as well. First, Harriet Dart ended a 19-month wait for a Grand Slam win. She beat Peyton Stearns. And then Jacob Fernie recovered from being 5-2 down in the fourth set before winning 10 of the next 11 games for a remarkable comeback against Spain's Martin Landeslithau.
Only a few weeks ago, I was 5-1, 40-15 down in a match and ended up winning it. So that was kind of playing on my mind. I knew it was possible. But obviously, yeah, things went my way and, managed to claw my way back.
Three-time major champion Stan Wawrinka has played his final Grand Slam match. The 41-year-old was given a standing ovation after his loss to Italy's Matteo Berrettini. He retires at the end of the season. In football, the defending champions Arsenal maintained their 100% start to the new Premier League season last night. They won 1-0 at Aston Villa. Mikel Arteta was running the match as manager for his 250th time. It's transfer deadline day, so prepare for eye-wateringly extravagant deals to be announced until the 11 p.m. deadline. Manchester City, for example, in talk to spend just £121 million on Argentina midfielder Enzo Fernandez from Chelsea. They, by the way, spent £65 million last night buying another midfielder, Iliman Ndiaye from Everton. And later today, Charlie Dean will lead a much-changed England cricket team in the first three one-day internationals against Ireland to round off their season. Alex Capsey will keep wicket for the first time. We'll be hearing from Charlie Dean in an hour's time. Commentary, BBC Sounds, 12:45.
Thank you, Jonathan. Let's look ahead to comedy this weekend on Radio 4.
Mums everywhere, beware.
We're turning the spotlight on you.
My mother is 10 out of 10 on the hysteria scale.
My mother and I are too similar for our own mental health.
Your mum is back with celebs spilling the beans on the funny side of motherhood.
Hello. Hello.
Here we go.
Kicking off the new series with comedians Sarah Barron and Nish Kumar.
At my 40th birthday, my mother kept going up to groups of strangers, not introducing herself and saying, all those stretch marks and for what? Nothing.
Join me, Laura Smith, for the new series of Your Mum. On Saturday night from 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
It's 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Johnny Diamond in London. Let's get a summary of the news from Caroline Nicholls.
Andy Burnham is preparing to face MPs for the first time as Prime Minister as Parliament returns from its summer break. He's expected to say he wants his government to unlock a feeling of positivity. Mr. Burnham will meet his cabinet this morning before facing questions from opposition parties in the Commons about how he'll fund his policies and whether he plans to raise taxes. The government is to use £110 million of existing budgets to create hundreds of extra prison places in England and Wales as it tries to ease overcrowding. The plans include the conversion of unused office space and laundries into cells in existing prisons. A former gang leader has been found guilty of the murder of the rapper Tupac Shakur almost 30 years after his death. A jury in Las Vegas convicted 63-year-old Dwayne Kiffee D. Davis of first-degree murder after deliberating for less than 3 hours. He was accused of orchestrating the drive-by shooting after a fight involving Tupac and Davis's nephew earlier that night. He's the only person ever to be charged in connection with the killing, and he could face life in prison. A 23-year-old man has been charged with two counts of murder in connection with a fire at a house near Middlesbrough last Wednesday. 7-year-old Valentina Foster and her 34-year-old aunt, Natalie McDonald, died in the blaze in Grangetown. Cleveland police said the man had also been charged with grievous bodily harm with intent. The Home Office says almost 7,500 people crossed the Channel in small boats between June and August, the lowest summer total for 6 years. It says closer cooperation with France has helped reduce the numbers, while the Conservatives say the fall is largely down to poor weather. Nepal's Prime Minister has said last week's devastating flash floods weren't an ordinary event but were driven by climate change. More than 900 people are confirmed to have died in Nepal. Another 4,000 people are still missing.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 26 minutes to 7. Politics is back. Westminster returns today after the summer recess. It'll be Andy Burnham's first time speaking in the Commons Chamber as PM. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, is in Downing Street bright and early this morning as excitement, I'm sure, pervades every crack of the pavement. Henry, what is the Prime Minister going to do today? He's obviously been out and about over the summer, but bringing it back to the Commons is a big moment.
Morning, Anna. Yes, I think it's a really big moment because we've had 6 weeks to get used to Andy Burnham as Prime Minister, and he's used that time to set out some policies, to give a sense of his instincts as Prime Minister. But actually seeing and feeling what he looks and sounds like as Prime Minister at the dispatch box of the House of Commons, especially given he hasn't appeared as a minister in the House of Commons for 16 years, is quite a moment. You will also get your first feeling for the mood on the Labour benches behind him. Of course, there are dozens of MPs who will be sitting behind him later today who were dispensed with by him when he became Prime Minister. Then there are those on the front bench who've been elevated by him, and we'll also get a sense for how opposition parties are going to respond to him. So all of that choreography and architecture of our new term will be fascinating. Andy Burnham also wants to set a new direction in the House of Commons today. There'll be things that we've heard a bit about over the summer, but I think there will be that important tonal shift. You heard that quote in the news summary there, that he's going to say he wants to unlock a feeling of positivity and possibility in every part of the country. We're told he will promise a sense of optimism. And then he will also say that he has a plan for growth and a plan for affordability. And the two prongs of that, one is establishing greater public control of essential services, what he sees as essential services, and the other prong is about decentralising power. And we'll hear more about Number 10 North, that new unit in Manchester, which he established 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, and of course, Henry, nothing is ever quite as rosy and positive as any Prime Minister might want it to be. So what about the challenges, the problems that Andy Burnham has to face today as well?
Well, we'll see the challenge of early release because we're going to hear from Alex Norris, the Justice Secretary, later on this programme, but also in the House of Commons after Andy Burnham later today. And I think that is just one example of how there are all sorts of thorny public policy dilemmas which Andy Burnham has inherited. Another one of those is defence. And I think we may well see over the course of the autumn defence spending becoming one of the big headaches for Andy Burnham, partly because of the clearly perilous global situation, which Andy Burnham can only really play a marginal role in impacting as the UK Prime Minister, but also because of his choice of Chancellor, John Healey, who's at the G20 summit in North Carolina today. And he's been giving an interview to the Times newspaper in which he said that he does want to set out a clear path to increasing defence spending at the spending review, which we're expecting next year. But of course, this is all particularly sensitive for John Healey because he delivered arguably the final crucial blow to Sir Keir Starmer when he resigned as Defence Secretary, saying that the Treasury should find the money to spend 3% of national income on defence by 2030. That is now his challenge as Chancellor.
And Henry, final thought on Kemi Badenoch, who didn't have much bank holiday rest. She's been reshuffling the Conservative shadow cabinet over the weekend.
Yes, she has. And she says it's in order to get her team election ready. I mean, it is very notable that she has removed from two of the top positions, Shadow Chancellor Mel Stride and Shadow Foreign Secretary Priti Patel, two figures who perhaps struggled with association with what Kemi Badenoch herself, let alone any of the Conservatives' political opponents, see as some of the failings of previous Conservative governments, welfare in Mel Stride's case and immigration in Priti Patel's case. In their place, Andrew Griffith, who has a FTSE 100 background, quite unusual among MPs, as Shadow Chancellor, and Tom Tugendhat, the former Security Minister, as Shadow Foreign Secretary.
Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent in Downing Street. Thank you.
22 minutes to seven, and more than £100 million out of the Justice Ministry's budget will be used to fast track the creation of new prison places by converting space in current prisons. The Justice Secretary is expected to outline the plan when he speaks to the Commons later today. Seema Kotecha is our senior UK correspondent. Seema, can you sort of sketch out the scale of the initiative as you understand it?
Yes, I mean, let's be clear here, Johnny. This £110 million is not new money. It's already been budgeted for, but it's being redirected to building hundreds of more prison places over the next 2 years in existing jails. So what ministers are saying, that unused space, such as laundry rooms or storage areas in existing prisons, will be converted into cells to help with overcrowding. But there are two questions here that keep coming up when I speak to staff about this plan. How much unused space is there in existing jails? I'm told not a lot. And they say if more inmates are going to be put into existing jails, they're going to need more staff to manage them. And at the moment, there aren't enough prison officers as is. They'll need more. So if there's a prison that holds 100 prisoners, let's say, and another 50 are put in, they're going to need a significant number of staff to monitor those individuals to make sure that they are rehabilitated and safe. Prison governors have also told me about maintenance issues in many prisons where there are cells but they can't be used. If we look at a National Audit Office report in 2024, it concluded a quarter, so around 23,000 prison places, didn't meet fire safety standards at the time. The Ministry of Justice says it's also signed a contract to start building a new jail for 1,700 inmates in Lancashire. It's not exactly clear when that project will begin, but we know that its completion date is not till 2031.
Seema Kotecha, thank you very much.
It's 20 to 7. We knew that the summer had been hot, and now on the first day of meteorological autumn, the figures are expected to confirm it. Well, not just confirm that it was hot, but also to confirm that it's been a record breaker. Ben Rich from the BBC Weather Centre is with us. Morning, Ben. Tell us a bit more about this.
Yeah, morning, Anna. Yes, to the first day of meteorological autumn, 1st of September. And what it means is the Met Office can now go and crunch all of the numbers, all of the temperatures that we've seen over the last 3 months, the summer months of June, July and August. Now, back on the 11th of August, the Met Office announced that we were on course for the hottest summer on record. All we needed between then and now were for temperatures to be around the average. If we saw average temperatures for the rest of the month, we would break that record. And it looks like we have seen temperatures average or indeed above. We had a spell of very hot weather through the middle part of August. Then temperatures returned closer to average. But we've seen nothing really that changes that projection. And so it is looking likely that the Met Office will announce later today that it has indeed been the hottest summer since records began. Those records began all the way back in 1884.
Yeah. What does that mean for us more broadly, Ben?
Well, what it means is that we've obviously had a year where hot weather has been able to happen. The weather patterns have been such that high pressure has been in charge for much of the time. Remember that 2-month-long dry spell that parts of southern England had. That area of high pressure close by has allowed things to be very, very dry. We saw the drought, we saw the wildfires, and also dry ground makes it easier for temperatures to climb. So there's a kind of weather aspect to this, but there is, of course, also a climate aspect to this. Now, heat waves and hot weather in summer is one of the things that scientists find easiest to pin on climate change, if you like, to see that relationship between the warming climate and those extremes of very high temperatures. And in terms of records, if we break the record again this year, we will have had our fifth hottest summers on record, all of them since the year 2000. So signs that our summers are getting hotter. Weather records should really be quite difficult to break. In a climate that isn't changing, we would expect it to be quite difficult to break a weather record. But of course, as the climate is warming. Those weather records are getting something of a leg up, and it seems they're getting easier and easier to break. We've seen a lot of records this summer. Number of 30-degree days, we've had 40 of them. The previous record was just 34 days. And we saw 10 days where temperatures climbed above 35 degrees. It happened in four consecutive calendar months, May, June, July, August. And that has never happened before.
Thank you, Ben. Ben Rich at the BBC Weather Centre. And from the big trends down to just what the weather for today looks like, Helen Willits will be with us just before seven.
It's 17 minutes to seven. And the UN's refugee agency, the UNHCR, has welcomed a confirmation from Pakistan that 16,000 Afghans have been temporarily exempted on humanitarian grounds from being deported to Afghanistan. Human rights groups say many more Afghans now in Pakistan are at risk of serious harm if they return to Taliban-ruled Afghanistan. The UN statement sent to the BBC said they stood ready to help establish procedures to permit vulnerable Afghans to apply for documentation to grant them protection. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, has just visited the main border crossing between Pakistan and Afghanistan at Torkham.
They call this Zero Point. It's the main crossing between Pakistan, about 50 metres away, and Afghanistan. And there's a tide of Afghan families coming through these metal gates. A woman with a goat on a rope, a man with a huge suitcase on his head, and three little girls, each of them carrying a rooster or a chicken. Entire families, many generations, who've grown up on the other side, spending decades there, and coming back to a country many have never even been to before.
The journey was very difficult. My husband had been deported 20 days earlier, and I had to borrow money from several people to make the journey. I have never been to Afghanistan before.
What do you say to the Pakistanis?
We spent many good years there and lived well, but this year the Pakistanis caused us a great deal of hardship. They would not allow my husband to work. There was work available, but he was afraid to go because the police might arrest him.
Every Afghan family we speak with speaks about being mistreated by the Pakistanis. Can't confirm that right here. But Pakistan has been saying that it's given refuge to millions of Afghans for decades through all of its wars, and it's time for the Afghans to go home. We're looking into this makeshift office, Taliban flags everywhere. Then from here, those who have documents can go on to the United Nations, and then they'll be given a refuge. The UN hopes for just a few days in a tented village nearby. Assalamu alaikum. Assalamu alaikum. Namatan Chief. What's your name?
My name is Saber.
How many in your family have been forced to come back to Afghanistan?
Talwesh.
I have seven brothers, my sister-in-law, their children, my children, all of us.
And what about your future? Can you start over again here?
The problem here is that there are no business or job opportunities in Afghanistan these days. However, I will do whatever work I can find.
And some of you, are you worried that some of your daughters, some of your nieces won't be able to go to school in Afghanistan?
Of course I am worried. They need an education. They should have the opportunity to become doctors, engineers, or whatever they choose to be in the future. Here they have no option but to stay at home with nothing to do.
Over the past 3 years, more than 6 million Afghans have been forced to come home in circumstances like this, either from Pakistan or from Iran on the other border. But forcing people to go home is a violation of international principles. Charlie Goodlake is the spokesperson in Kabul for the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR.
We haven't seen returns on this level anywhere in the world in recent history. This is almost a medium-sized country that is coming back to Afghanistan and having to reintegrate and to reabsorb.
The Taliban authorities are facing crises of their own. Could they do this, respond to the needs of these people on their own?
I do not believe that they can do this alone. I don't think there's many countries in the world that could receive 6 million people on their own. But let me be also very clear, we're also here to raise challenges with them where we have disagreements, and those are on very clear issues about girls going back to school, about our national staff being able to come back to UN offices.
We're heading now to see someone who was deported twice. He's not just worried about being here, he's terrified. He used to police the streets for the government, ousted by the Taliban. We can't reveal his location, his identity. Tell me what your life is like now.
I feel that my life is under threat and I can't even go outside. I spent all my day at home.
The Taliban authorities have offered an amnesty. You don't believe them?
I do not believe in their amnesty at all. I have no trust in it because many of my friends were killed.
Did you try to find a way out?
I tried, but I do not know where I can go. I'm afraid to travel because something might happen to me, God forbid. I live with these fears all the time.
The biggest forced return in the world shows no sign of stopping, and a world preoccupied by so many other crises seems to take little notice.
Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. It's 11 minutes to 7. Researchers have found that the time of day at which cancer patients get their treatment could have a significant effect on survival rates. Those who had morning sessions rather than afternoon ones could survive for twice as long. The figures suggest that have been looked at in this particular study. Professor Paul Lorigan is a consultant medical oncologist at the Christie Cancer Hospital in Manchester, senior author of this study. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tell me a little bit more about the numbers that you've looked at here and what it is that you found.
So we looked at patients receiving predominantly immunotherapy. Immunotherapy has revolutionized the treatment of cancer, but not everybody benefits from it equally. And there are many possible reasons for that, the type of cancer, the type of treatment, their own immune system. But one of the things we looked at was whether the circadian rhythm or the body clock has an impact on the immune system. And so we looked at over 2,500 patients treated in Manchester with a range of different cancers and a range of different types of immunotherapy. And what we found was that patients treated earlier in the day had, in general, a better outcome than patients treated later in the day. Now, it varied from cancer type and it varied with treatment type as well.
And how confident are you that this is a real theme, if you like? Because there was people might remember, there was a similar study earlier this year, which was then retracted. Is this something that you are confident is happening?
No, absolutely. I mean, what I think we're seeing here is a strong signal. What you're referring to is a study from China in lung cancer, and that was withdrawn because of problems with the data. But what we've looked at here is what's called a retrospective study, and there are many possible explanations for why this might be, and that we haven't actually been able to see in our trial. So it might be that people arriving for treatment later are less well, are more frail, are relying on hospital transport, etc. So we really need to look at this more systematically. And as a result, with colleagues in Southampton and in Cardiff, we've designed a trial to test this properly to see if this is real, and if it is real, why it's real, to understand why the immune system might be more receptive at specific times of the day.
Mm. Is it the sort of thing, and you know, we're going further down the line now, where if it does turn out that there's something in it, that the system could cope with everybody wanting their treatment at the same time of day?
No, that's a very good question. And what we see is that the people who get the best outcome with immunotherapy get it early on. And so it's most likely it's just important for the first two or three or four cycles of treatment. And for a big center who's treating, you know, individual patients for up to 2 years, it would be quite possible just to give the first three or four cycles of treatment first thing in the morning, and then all the rest of the treatments would be given at a later time. And the potential benefits here, if it comes up to proof, the sort of difference we've seen, we don't see that when we're trying to improve our treatments. We're adding in new drugs, more expensive drugs, causing more side effects. But this would be essentially cost neutral. It's just if it works, a significant benefit just based on giving the treatment at a different time of the day.
I see. It's really interesting. Thank you for telling us about it, Professor Paul Lorigan, who's a senior author of that study, a consultant medical oncologist at the Christie Cancer Hospital in Manchester.
7 minutes to 7. Just how much oil is getting out of the Middle East and getting to world markets and consumers? The White House said on Sunday that Gulf oil exports have recovered to 2/3 of pre-war levels. And we heard yesterday from Joel Rayburn, a former US National Security Council member who worked on President Trump's strategy towards Tehran in the president's first term.
At the same time that oil production, oil exports have ticked back up slowly, gradually, almost toward pre-war levels or within enough range of pre-war levels that the deficit can be made up in other regions of the world or by releases from strategic reserves elsewhere, the Iranians are exporting next to nothing.
It's much harder to tell how many ships are getting through the choke point of the Strait of Hormuz now because they don't want to be seen for fairly obvious reasons. So they're turning off the thing that broadcasts their identity and their positions, their transponders. The Strait was an important route out of the Gulf, not the only route, and oil is currently trading at around $20 a barrel more than it was before the war. Siad Daoud is the chief emerging markets economist for Bloomberg Economics, also senior fellow at Harvard Kennedy School's Middle East Initiative. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for joining us. The White House and Trump supporters, like Mr. Rayburn, are pretty bullish. Do their claims stand up?
Well, I think there's still a shortfall of oil flows from the Middle East to the world. I mean, if you look at the numbers, they're quite simple. If you look at what traders are saying, they're saying about, at best, about 8 million barrels a day of oil are going through Hormuz. 8 million compared to 20 million that we had before the war, there is a shortfall. Mm. Now, even if you take alternative routes into account, for example, Saudi Arabia is exporting most of its oil now through the Red Sea rather than through the Strait of Hormuz, similar for the UAE and Oman, that adds up to about 15 million barrels a day. That's still shorter or below the 20 million barrels that the Middle East used to provide to the world. And frankly, the most important number we should look at is the oil price. Today, oil prices are over $90 per barrel. At the beginning of the year, they were $60 per barrel. If Middle Eastern oil flows were flowing normally, oil should be close to 60 than to 90.
There is another side to the equation, isn't there? That demand appears to have been rather tamped down by China, either because it's releasing from its reserves or it's actually switching the fuels that it uses. Is that having an impact?
Of course it's having an impact. I mean, if you lose some oil, then the world has to adapt. Yeah. And it adapts in the following way. You either have to produce oil from elsewhere, and that takes time, or you reduce your demand. And that is how the global economy is basically adapting to the shortfall of oil from the Middle East. China is doing a lot of the heavy lifting, but also other countries, especially in Asia. And what they're doing is they're doing one of two things. They're either consuming less oil and using other energy sources, either clean or dirty, like coal, or they're reducing the total energy consumption. And that's the way that the world is adapting to the energy shortages that we're getting from the Middle East as a result of the Iran war.
And briefly, Siad, what of the situation with Iran? Is it, as the White House says, zero Iranian oil has been exported since the blockade began?
It's hard to tell. It's already hard to tell how much Iran is exporting before the war. It's hard to tell how many ships are going through the Strait of Hormuz. It is possible that Iranian oil exports are near zero, but it's also possible that Iranian oil exports could recover at some point. And, you know, they switch their transponders off and basically buyers in Asia, especially China, ends up buying that. But it's hard to track and tell for sure.
Siad Daoud, thank you very much for joining us.
It's just a couple of minutes to seven. Later this week, Radio 4 goes back to 1066.
Norman Day on BBC Radio 4.
1066, perhaps the most famous year in all of English history. And in a special edition of You're Dead to Me, we're exploring what led to the seismic Battle of Hastings.
Harold ends up in Normandy.
We don't know what. He's trying some croissants.
The story has it all. Multiple battles, an alleged illicit affair, and a lot of horses.
If you've got, say, 3,000 horses, how much poo do you think would they produce?
Join me, Greg Jenner, and my guests for You're Dead to Me, part of Norman Day on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, this Thursday afternoon at 4.
It's 2 minutes to 7. Let's get the weather forecast with Helen Willetts.
Johnny, thanks very much indeed. Low pressure's with us today, so there's more rain on the cards in the north in particular. Ridge of high pressure's building across England and Wales, though, so that means less shower activity than we've had in recent days. It's quite a sunny start, actually, for many. Still some strength in that sunshine, despite it being September the 1st, start of the meteorological autumn. Temperatures will get up to around about 20 to 23 degrees quite widely today, with that morning sunshine really helping. We do have a scattering of showers across Cumbria, one or two across the South Wales coast and drifting into parts of Devon and Cornwall as well. And there'll be one or two showers breaking out inland as we go into the afternoon, but nowhere near or as widespread and heavy as recent days. Northern Ireland, though, have a weather front and the breeze is picking up a little bit here, which will carry the rain further south and east as we go through the day. So the sunshine will be best this morning and then it will tend to fill in with that frontal cloud coming in, 17 or 18 are high here. The same front, which is already affecting Scotland with some fairly heavy rain now coming in across the Western Isles, which is going to push its way southwards and eastwards to all parts through the morning, brightening up to the north later on. Temperatures, though, 17 or 18, bit of a brisk breeze around today.
Thanks, Helen. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Johnny Diamond in London.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Tuesday the 1st of September. The headlines this morning, Andy Burnham is to promise a feeling of positivity when he makes his first Commons appearance as Prime Minister today, but is facing questions about public spending and prisons. A jury in Las Vegas has found a former gang leader guilty of the murder of Tupac Shakur, 30 years after the rapper was shot dead. And shares in the Chinese fast fashion company Shein have fallen sharply after it began trading on the stock market in Hong Kong.
Also coming up in the next hour, as Lionel Messi quits international football and questions are asked about how much longer Novak Djokovic can go on, when is the best time to call it a day?
I don't think any athlete really knows when is exactly the right time to retire. It's very hard because it's like a rock star that doesn't want to get off the stage.
Annabelle Croft and former Lioness Ellen White will give us their thoughts. And Freddie Mercury's best friend, Mary Austin, who he nearly married, speaks to David Sillitoe about their complicated relationship.
There's a reported conversation where he said to you that he thought he was bisexual, and you said,
"No, I think you're gay." Yes, that was me explaining without so many words that I'm not a menage a trois.
The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
Andy Burnham is preparing for his first parliamentary appearance as Prime Minister, where he's expected to tell MPs he wants to create a sense of optimism in Britain. Mr. Burnham is scheduled to meet his cabinet this morning before heading to the House of Commons to face questions. The Conservatives and Reform UK are expected to demand more details about how the Prime Minister will pay for the policies he's announced so far. Our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, reports.
Andy Burnham has been in office for 6 weeks now, but we've never seen him in Parliament as Prime Minister. In fact, it's 16 years since he's appeared in the Commons as a minister. In his first outing today, Mr. Burnham will seek to describe the broad direction his government will take, focusing in particular on two areas. He will talk about his desire to secure stronger public control of essential services, and he will offer more detail on Number 10 North, explaining how he hopes it will fundamentally reshape how the country is run. Perhaps the biggest difference that the Prime Minister hopes to establish with what came before is tonal. He will promise a sense of optimism about Britain's future, saying that his programme for government will unlock a feeling of positivity and possibility in every part of the country. The Conservatives and Reform UK are questioning how new measures will be funded. The Greens say he should commit to bringing water and energy companies under full public ownership. And the Liberal Democrats have said his plans to tackle the crisis over prison places are inadequate.
The government says it will invest £110 million in building hundreds of new prison places in existing jails in England and Wales. Unused spaces will be converted into cells. The Justice Secretary, Alex Norris, is expected to set out further details later today about the plan to release some offenders early to avoid running out of prison places. Our senior UK correspondent, Seema Kotecha, reports.
This money comes from the Ministry of Justice's existing budget, so the cash isn't new, but the initiative is. The government says the £110 million will now be used to accelerate the construction of hundreds of prison places over the next couple of years. It says all of the money will be spent on converting existing spaces in prisons, such as unused laundry rooms and storage areas, into cells. But prison governors say they're already lacking staff, and the plan means they'll require more prison officers to manage the additional offenders and keep them safe. The governors also spoke of serious maintenance issues in prisons, which meant many cells couldn't be used. The Ministry of Justice says in addition to creating more cells in existing prisons, it's also signed a contract to start building a new jail for 1,700 inmates in Lancashire.
A former gang leader has become the first man to be convicted over the notorious murder of the rapper Tupac Shakur, who was shot dead in Las Vegas in 1996. Dwayne Davis, who's now 63, had denied ordering the killing. Tupac Shakur was one of the biggest stars in rap music, and his shooting, as part of a feud, had been surrounded by rumours and conspiracy for years. Our correspondent, Shaima Khalil, has been following the case and sent this report.
Count one, murder with use of a deadly weapon. Guilty of first-degree murder with use of a deadly weapon.
Dwayne Davis showed no reaction as the guilty verdict was announced. The 63-year-old sat with a neutral expression before being led from the courtroom by officers. For more than 2 weeks, jurors heard from former gang associates, eyewitnesses, and police detectives about Tupac's killing and what led to it. Prosecutors said Davis orchestrated the attack after Tupac and his entourage assaulted his nephew at a Las Vegas casino. They said he supplied the gun and repeatedly admitted his involvement in interviews and a memoir. His lawyer argued those accounts were fiction, told for fame and money, and said there was no physical evidence placing Davis at the scene. But the jury rejected the defense. Davis now faces a potential life sentence.
Ukraine says at least 10 people have been killed in the latest Russian attacks on Kyiv. Seven of those died in a missile strike on a rail depot. The repeated attacks have led to stricter security procedures being put in place across the country ahead of the start of the new school year this morning. Rescuers in Nepal have been working through the night to try to reach hundreds of workers feared to be trapped in tunnels at a hydroelectric power plant. More than 980 people are confirmed to have died in the country after last week's flash flooding, and a further 4,000 are missing. Search operations are also continuing in Tibet, where Chinese authorities say 16 people have died and 500 are unaccounted for. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker reports from Beijing.
In Nepal, the families of more than 600 workers believed to be trapped in a vast network of mud-filled tunnels are clinging to hope their loved ones can be found alive. Engineers did manage to pump air into the tunnels over the weekend as experts from China and India joined the operation. A team did manage to gain entry to one tunnel, but withdrew after finding no one there. In Tibet, the Chinese-appointed Panchen Lama, the second highest spiritual leader in Tibetan Buddhism, held a memorial service in the region as search teams continued to wade through waist-high mud to find more than 500 people still missing. The base of a single water tower is the only structure still standing in the once bustling border crossing with Nepal.
A 23-year-old man has been charged with two counts of murder in connection with a fire at a house near Middlesbrough last Wednesday. 7-year-old Valentina Foster and her 34-year-old aunt, Natalie MacDonald, died in the blaze in Gragetown. Four others were injured. Cleveland police said the man had also been charged with grievous bodily harm with intent. Shares in the online fast fashion retailer Shein have fallen by around 10% in Hong Kong after its long-awaited stock market debut. The company's business model of rapidly producing and selling clothes at ultra-low prices from its factories in China has faced growing scrutiny in recent years. Archana Shukla has more.
Shein was once estimated to be worth almost $100 billion. Today, it's valued at roughly a quarter of that. The brand has been hugely popular, especially with younger shoppers, for one simple reason. The latest fashion trends, dirt cheap, shipped straight from its vast factory network in China. But now growth has slowed sharply, costs are rising, and competition is fierce. Add to that trade tensions. Both the US and EU have removed tax breaks on small parcel imports, hitting Shane right where it hurts. It's ultra-low prices. When the stock opened trading today, it fell heavily but recovered some ground. This stock listing comes after failed attempts in New York and London, where regulators raised concerns about Shane's labour practices and environmental record.
The rollout of this year's winter flu vaccine begins today. Health leaders say it's been updated to protect against last year's so-called super flu, which arrived earlier than expected and put intense pressure on the NHS. Here's our health editor, Hugh Pym.
School children and pregnant women will be the first groups eligible for a free NHS flu vaccine this month. From October, preschool children aged 2 or over, people aged 65 or over, and patients with some long-term health conditions will be among those who can get it. Vaccines are updated annually to match predicted types of the flu virus, which will circulate. This includes the strain which officials say had a major impact on patients last year and put enormous pressure on services. NHS leaders insist there'll be enough vaccine stock to go round after reports of delivery problems. Some GPs had orders for millions of doses cancelled by one manufacturer and had to seek alternative suppliers.
The Met Office will publish provisional figures this afternoon, which are expected to show that this summer was the UK's hottest since records began in 1884. It would break the record set just last year. But despite the extreme heat, wet weather in some parts of the country means the summer is unlikely to set a new record for dryness.
Thanks, Caroline. It's 9 minutes past seven. For 30 years, the killing of Tupac Shakur has prompted furious argument, conspiracy theories and endless commentary in newspapers, broadcasts and online. Tupac was one of the biggest rap stars of his time, with hits like California Love. Amidst all the argument over his death in Las Vegas in September 1996, one thing was missing, a conviction. Well, now we have one, and it springs from the words of the man convicted. Dwayne Davis acknowledged his role in the killing over and over again on podcasts and in books. Overnight, he was convicted of one count of murder, and outside the court building, Tupac Shakur's fans wept. Former Tupac producer Daryl Harper spoke to journalists after the verdict.
I don't want to get emotional, but yeah, I still miss him. I'm glad we got a verdict. His spirit can fly now. It's free.
KJ Matthews is an entertainment journalist who's been following the case closely from the beginning. I spoke with her after the court had dispersed.
30 years ago, this month, rapper Tupac Shakur was murdered in Las Vegas. And today is a day we find the person responsible for that, according to the jurors. They basically found 63-year-old Dwayne Keith Davis, or also known as Dwayne Keffy Davis, guilty of first-degree murder with the use of a deadly weapon. They are not saying that he was the one that pulled the trigger. What they're saying is that he orchestrated it. He was the shot caller. And the reason that he did it was because earlier that night, his nephew was assaulted by the CEO of Death Row Records and Tupac Shakur. And there was surveillance video showing that. So this was kind of like a retribution hit where he was in the vehicle that pulled up next to the car that Tupac Shakur was in and then handed the gun off to what he says was his nephew, and that he fired the shots that killed Tupac. Now, even though within the last year or so, he's saying that all of this was just a much ado about nothing. But unfortunately, because there were so many years where he went around saying that he had a part in the killing of Tupac Shakur, he allowed the memoir to be written, even though he said he didn't write it. He talked to podcasters. He talked to law enforcement. He talked to journalists, and nothing happened until 3 years ago when he was arrested and charged with first degree murder. And only after he was arrested did he recant and say, all the things I've been saying before was a lie. I was saying it for fame and fortune.
So he spends years, even decades, saying he was involved, he effectively commissioned the crime, organized the crime, whatever, then denies it, but the jury does not buy it. the jury
no.
says, you've done it.
You've done it. They're saying yes. His testimony or his recordings in the past is what really sank him.
Can we talk about the broader significance? Because this isn't just about the killing of one very high-profile star. There was a much bigger and is a much bigger cultural significance to this, isn't there? When it comes to 90s gang culture, when it comes to hip hop in America,
yes.
when it comes to East Coast and West Coast. I mean, it's a sprawling story, isn't it?
Back in the 90s, particularly, and even the late 80s, gang culture, specifically in Compton and Los Angeles, and East Coast versus West Coast rappers, even though Tupac Shakur was born on the East Coast, he was raised in California, and he really was the sound of West Coast rap, especially when he signed with Death Row Records. So there was a lot of antagonism going back and forth. And it also was what people call snitch culture, where people knew what was going on with all these shootings, but people were afraid to speak. Even one of the witnesses for the prosecution said she didn't speak for more than a decade because she was just scared. You know, she was so scared that something would happen to her. So it does go back to gang culture.
KJ Matthews, thank you very much.
It is 14 minutes past seven now. More than £100 million is going to be spent on building new prison places in jails in England and Wales. Now, this money is coming from existing budgets. What it will see is things like storage areas, laundry rooms, unused office space turned into cells instead. But prison governors are saying that doesn't help with one of the biggest issues, the lack of staff, and creating more spaces to hold inmates without addressing that shortage will only cause more problems. Well, Nick Hardwick joins us this morning, former chair of the Parole Board, former HM Chief Inspector of Prisons. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
We know that this is a huge problem. It's a tricky nut to crack. It's been a thorn in the side of successive governments. Does this look like the answer to you, or is it, again, just not getting to the heart of the problem?
I think it will possibly have a small amount of impact. But essentially what's happened to now is that the prison building plans that do include increasing the capacity of existing prisons are way behind schedule. And so this won't be enough to hold back the inevitable crisis that will occur when the system runs out of space unless something much more significant is done to reduce the prison population. You know, back when under the Tory government, when the system ran out of space, trials were delayed, sentencing was, judges withheld sentencing until space became available. Judges were warned not to send some people to prison because prison conditions had deteriorated so much. So there is a real danger here that the system will run out of space. And even with the measures the government is suggesting, if there was to be a prison riot that took some capacity out of the system, if there was to be disturbances that involved a sudden increase in the prison population, then you would have, the system would collapse. It is a very dangerous situation and it requires a significant, substantial response.
And when you talk there about doing something much more significant, it sounds like anything short of physically building new prisons won't cut it. But obviously that takes a long time, as we know, and that there are questions about whether or not enough money has been allocated to do that. Is there any way to do something significant quickly, or is that simply not an option?
The government has already spent, according to the National Audit Office, £10 billion, that's billion pounds, building new prison places. And that simply takes time to come into effect, let alone whether the money is there to do it. And that doesn't include the problem of recruiting staff and letting those staff get the experience they need to run prisons successfully. So the only thing you can do is to reduce the prison population to give us a bit of space. Anyone who pretends otherwise is simply not being straightforward in their assessment, I would say.
And this, as we said, this is not new money. This is existing money, which is being pushed towards converting. I mean, is that the sort of thing that you think will work to take these spaces and convert them into cells?
It would help, right? So there will be some unused space in some prisons that you could use, but it will be a small amount because that unused space needs to be where the kind of cells in the prison are, where they can be managed. If you have a building, for instance, that's not used, that's in a completely different part of the prison, You can't put prisoners there because you won't have the staff available to manage it. So you might, this will have potentially some small impact, but it won't be enough to resolve the overall crisis. You need to be clear about that. It's a few hundred places. We need a few thousand.
And just as a final thought, I know you have thoughts about these sentences, indeterminate sentences for public protection, and that's been identified as one of the areas where the government thinks it can free up some prison spaces. But there are technicalities, people who potentially can be released, but people who shouldn't. How should that be managed to basically ensure public safety?
Something does need to be done about that. Back in 2022, the all-party, cross-party Justice Committee made a very sensible proposal that essentially was to re-sentence people who had been given an IPP sentence, to wind the clock back a bit, if you like, and give them the sentence they would have had had the IPP sentence not been in existence. I think you can do that. But what you also need to do, and this applies more generally, is something about the growth in the recall population. The recall population has grown exponentially. There's no objectively good reason for that. And that is an area where I think the government could have some impact on the prison population relatively quickly and relatively cost effectively. There's no risk-free option. About 2 out of 5 of everybody released from prison reoffends. But if we want to reduce the number of future victims, what we've got to do is give the prison system a better chance of doing the work they need to do to change people's behaviour, not simply keep on piling on the pressure by keeping more and more people in prison, which I think often is more about protecting the reputation of politicians than is about protecting the public from future offending.
I'll put some of those thoughts to the Justice Secretary, Alex Norris, in an hour's time. Nick Hardwick, former Chair of the Parole Board, former HM Chief Inspector of Prisons. Thank you.
19 minutes past 7. Shop prices are rising at their fastest rate in more than 2 years, with food prices in particular picking up again. Leanna's back with more.
That's right, Johnny. So shop prices rose by 1.5% in the year to August. That's according to the British Retail Consortium. Food prices rose by more sharply by 2.8%. Helen Dickinson is Chief Executive of the British Retail Consortium and joins me now. Helen, so food inflation's jumped from 2.2% to 2.8% in a month. How much of these higher costs have retailers passed on already, and how much more could still be coming?
Well, what we're seeing is some of the energy costs, higher commodity costs, beginning to filter through. So inflation is tipping back up and probably will continue in that direction as those prices take a long time to feed through supply chain. So it's mainly in food, as you say, but we're also seeing non-food, particularly electricals, that inflation is starting to increase. So those are year-on-year numbers. And, you know, retailers are still competing really competitively with each other, which is holding that down to an extent. But, you know, those global factors, as well as a number of, you know, government decisions, higher employment costs, higher taxes, those are filtering through too. So there are some things within the government's control that can really help mitigate some of the cost of living as we look forward to.
Just to focus on foods, is there particular foods where shoppers would expect to notice those increases most over the next few months?
Well, particularly in sort of ambient products. So those are sort of more processed goods. They're imported, so they're more exposed to those higher energy costs. They require more processing. We are seeing global commodity prices rising in some areas, particularly as a result of some of the climate impacts that we've seen with the really hot weather and the combination of that and those government imposed costs is really what's driving it. Mm. And I think the key now is to make sure that, you know, this trend of this uptick that we've just seen really doesn't continue as we head into the rest of the year.
Well, Parliament's back and you've called on the government to cut the cost of doing business, including rates and other taxes. Now, in a statement, the government says it's already taken measures to help businesses and households. So what specifically do you want it to do now?
Well, obviously, we've got the budget coming up in October, so really decisive action, particularly on employment costs, making sure that the cost of employing, particularly young people, so we've got a lot of focus on people who are not in employment, education and training. There are nearly a million of those people. Mm. We've seen the taxes on employing young people really rise over the course of the last 2 years on the back of some of the budget decisions taken on national insurance in 2024. Okay. So mitigating some of that going forward and looking more widely at business rates. So the what the government has announced, the Prime Minister has announced for pubs has been great, but there's definitely more that they can do that would really mitigate some of the impacts going forward.
All right. Helen Dickinson, Chief Executive of the British Retail Consortium. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Leanna. It is 23 minutes past seven. When Freddie Mercury died in 1991, he left his home and everything he owned to the woman he'd been engaged to in the 1970s. Mary Austin was part of the Queen frontman's life to the very end and was with him every day in his final weeks. Now, inspired by the rediscovery of an old book filled with Freddie's lyrics, she's finally written about their lives together. To mark that and an exhibition of Freddie Mercury's costumes at the Victoria and Albert Museum, she agreed to sit down with our media and arts correspondent, David Sillito.
Is this the real life?
I'm Mary Austin, and it's very hard to describe who I was in Freddie's life, but I would just say very dear friend, very trusted friend.
Friend is perhaps an understatement. They were, in the 70s, engaged, and Mary stayed a part of his life to the very end.
The book began as a rediscovery of the lyrics packed in a loft. I felt that now I'm much older, I can afford to share more of Freddie. The lyrics gave me a better platform in which to do that.
A lot of people have wondered about the song Love of My Life. Is that about you?
Love of my life, you've heard.
I think not. But I do recognise the end of the song when we're old and grey.
I'll be there at your side to remind you how I still love you.
I will be there at your side to remind you how I still love you.
It was a conversation we were having, as you do, I suppose, when you're young and you feel that your life is journeying forward. And I just said this in passing.
Back home to me because you don't know what it's to.
When did you begin to realise that maybe you weren't going to have a life together as man and wife?
Probably in about the mid-70s. But it's life-changing and altering moments that you live through. You assert yourself and have to go forward.
There's a reported conversation where he said to you that he thought he was bisexual and you said,
no, I think you're gay. Yes, yes. That was me explaining, without so many words, that I'm not a menage a trois. But I still supported him, was also meant in that statement.
And then you essentially became like a PA then, didn't you?
I did. It was his offer. He wanted me to stay, so I thought about it and said I would. I couldn't imagine him ever not being in my life.
But you're more than just an employee. He moves his piano into your flat. You're there every day with him, aren't you?
I'm someone who can probably speak the truth at the worst times.
One of those moments is just before Live Aid, isn't it? He was reluctant and you pushed it.
Little, I think, yes. So much so that he didn't speak to me for about a week.
It's very soon after that that his health begins to fade, isn't it?
Yes. And that was his hesitation, I realise, in retrospect. But from there, I think he found an immense confidence. He played with the audience and they responded.
And you're with him every day towards the end, aren't you?
Yes. He was on quite a bit of morphine. So we had moments together. But in the earlier part of them, he would play recordings from the studio. We'd talk about them. And these were days when Eliza was one of them.
Those were the days of our lives.
It seems to fit his life at that moment.
There's that final moment, isn't there?
When he looks in the camera and says, I still love you.
It feels like a goodbye, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It just shows how brave, how strong he was.
But I fight, I still love you.
Just reminds you listening to that, doesn't it? What an absolute talent Freddie Mercury was. That's David Sillitoe reporting. And at 28 minutes past seven, Jonathan Ledyard's here with the sport.
Morning again. There was an Alice band instead of a buzz cut, a compression sleeve to manage his wrist injury. Otherwise, Carlos Alcaraz returned to playing singles tennis like he'd never been away. He won his first round match last night at the US Open in straight sets with no sign of any discomfort or rustiness after 4.5 months away from the court.
Well, I was trying to enjoy as much as I can. Easy to say, difficult to do. And after the match, you know, my body felt great. I'm just really, really happy that I made it finally.
Two British players also enjoyed days to remember in New York. Harriet Dart ended a 19-month wait for a Grand Slam win, and Jacob Fernie recovered from being 5-2 down in the fourth set to win in five. Expect a very different Pakistan cricket team to play England in the third and final test next week. The tourists have responded to Sunday's series defeat by dropping seven players, calling up five uncapped players and releasing their head coach. There'll also be a new look to Charlie Dean's England team, which plays today, the first of three one-day internationals against Ireland in Leicester. A number of senior players are rested. Alice Capsey will keep wicket for the first time for a country. But for Dean, with two series wins as captain already this season, she's been telling me she continues to learn from predecessors like Nat Sivabrunt and Heather Knight.
Heather is a really determined character and really leads from the front within her actions, and that's something that I'd love to take into my game. And Nat's calmness and presence and the way she empowers her bowlers and the girls to go about their business, and I guess trying to take elements of that as well, but equally doing it in my own way, that everyone's unique and it would be hard to emulate like someone else's captaincy style in that total way, but trying to take little pieces that I've learned from them along the way. And then I guess having Lottie as well as head coach and really experienced captain that she was, and her intricacies for the game and how she views the game, and trying to learn as much as possible from that.
Talking about Charlotte Edwards then, how do you think the squad is evolving under her since the Ashes, 16 months ago?
Feels like we're on a bit of a journey from a few years of World Cups where we not quite got into the finals and potentially underperformed to getting into that World Cup final, that home World Cup final. It felt like we're starting to fulfill our potential a little bit. And that ruthless nature, I think, that Lottie had as a player, as a captain, is also how she is as a coach, and trying to inspire a lot of those great things from us as well.
How challenging will it be to ensure that the new players you've got, because it's a much younger squad for this series against Ireland, how do you ensure that you get that ruthlessness, which you just talked about, to make sure that you win?
It provides a brilliant opportunity, this tour, for a few of the younger girls to really make their name, and I guess trying to encourage them to take the opportunity and enjoy it as much as possible, but equally trying to cash in. You know, we have players that are probably going to get a few more opportunities than they had previously in an England shirt, and yeah, it's an exciting little challenge for us. Ireland are a brilliant team full of very skillful players, so we're definitely not underestimating them at all. So I guess a bit of a newer squad, but equally, you know, lots of ambition.
One other thought, how do you view 2026 overall? We've talked about a World Cup final, you had that historic test at Lord's, you've done well in these series against New Zealand and India. Where are you in terms of out of 10?
How would you rate it so far with this series to come against Ireland?
We're up there. I'm giving it like a good 8 out of 10 in terms of the lessons that have been learned. And it feels like we're really growing and progressing as a squad. And that's a larger squad of 18, 20 players that have played for England this year. And that World Cup final felt like a little milestone in that. But equally, we've got so much further to go. But I guess just trying to view every opportunity we have to play for England as something that's really exciting and positive. And yeah, home Ashes next year. So I suppose that's our next little hurdle and something that we're going to really look to push towards and be at our best for.
Charlie Dean, good luck to her and the cricket team. Sunshine forecast as well for Leicester. Commentary on Test Match Special from 12:45, BBC Sounds.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. Ahead of this month's National Suicide Memorial Day for health and care workers, File on 4 investigates the reality of doctors at risk of suicide.
I'm Lalit Vijayadoru. As a doctor myself, I know what a medical career can be like.
The system forgets that we are humans.
The stresses, the strains.
I felt really drained and unsupported.
And the sometimes unbearable pressure.
I couldn't function. I couldn't see a future. I made preparations to end my life.
For File on 4 Investigates, I'm finding out why one doctor dies by suicide every 3 weeks and what needs to change to prevent it. Medical Emergency on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, tonight at 8.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And at 27 minutes to 8, Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
Andy Burnham is preparing to face MPs for the first time as Prime Minister as Parliament returns from its summer break. He's expected to say he wants to decentralise power and unlock a feeling of positivity. Mr Burnham will meet his cabinet this morning before facing questions from opposition parties in the Commons about how he'll fund the policies he's announced so far and whether he plans to raise taxes. The government is to use £110 million of existing budgets to create hundreds of extra prison places in England and Wales to try to ease overcrowding. The plans include the conversion of unused office space and laundries into cells in existing prisons. But prison governors say they're already lacking staff, and the plan means they'll require more prison officers to manage the additional offenders and keep them safe. A former gang leader has been found guilty of the murder of the rapper Tupac Shakur almost 30 years after his death. A jury in Las Vegas convicted 63-year-old Dwayne Davis of first-degree murder after deliberating for less than 3 hours. He was accused of orchestrating the drive-by shooting. Ukraine says at least 10 people have been killed in the latest Russian attacks on Kyiv. 7 of those died in a missile strike on a rail depot. The repeated attacks have led to stricter security procedures being put in place across the country ahead of the start of the new school year this morning. Nepal's Prime Minister has said last week's devastating flash floods weren't an ordinary event but were driven by climate change. More than 1,000 people are confirmed to have died in Nepal and Tibet, with 4,500 people still missing. Shares in the online fast fashion retailer Shein have fallen by around 10% in Hong Kong after its long-awaited stock market debut. The company had previously sought to list in New York and London, but those attempts stalled amid concerns about its labour practices and environmental record.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 25 to 8 now when Andy Burnham returns to the dispatch box later today to address the Commons for the first time as Prime Minister. Who controls our essential services will be one of the themes at the top of his agenda. He's expected to tell MPs that stronger control and not leaving it all in the hands of private companies will help to boost growth and cut the cost of living. So, is he right? Let's discuss the theory with our business editor, Simon Jack. Morning, Simon.
Morning, Anna.
So when Andy Burnham talks about greater public control, what does he mean? Because the terminology is important here.
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is that it doesn't necessarily mean public ownership. Now, the exemplar often looked to is the Manchester bus network. And there, the authority did not take over ownership and the running of the buses. Transport for Greater Manchester set the timetables, the fares, and then invited operators to bid for the contract to run them for a set fee, rather than the previous thing where the private operators were in deregulated model, deciding what they wanted to offer, how much, and taking all the profits or swallowing the losses, which, by the way, often saw the authority having to bail out loss-making operators the same some routes and services. So they will argue that model was good for growth, for jobs, for investment, because passengers would have a reliable and affordable service to get to work, which is good for the local economy. Operators would know what the return they would get would be. And that made the transport system more stable. But there is some subsidy in that. So that's not a free lunch. But you can contrast that with what's happening on the rail network, where the government is basically taking public ownership as those franchises, as those contracts expire. So even there, it means different things in different industries.
So where could we first see potentially Andy Burnham exerting this public control, Simon?
Well, I think the obvious and urgent case is Thames Water, which many people were expecting he might at least temporarily nationalise and put in a special administration in pretty short order. But the government realises that it's quite a complicated legal and financial process, and the private group, which is trying to take control, are seeing whether they can offer sufficient concessions, things like a golden share for the government to veto big decisions, for greater involvement of local authorities, give some devolution vibes in there, in order to satisfy what is quite a vague definition of greater public control. Those discussions are ongoing. And then, of course, you saw full nationalisation in the case of British Steel, which in the last days of the Starmer government, they decided we need a sovereign steelmaking capacity, so took it over from its previous Chinese owners. So greater public control means different things for different industries. And I think people are trying to pick through that, as we go ahead.
Yeah, well, in theory, have a bit more light shone on that later today. Thank you, Simon. Simon Jack there. Andrew Fisher's with us as well, columnist, former director of policy at the Labour Party, where he wrote the 2017 Labour Manifesto. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning.
I think a lot of people are waiting to see the direction of travel today, because when this came up during the by-election in Makerfield, and in fact, even in the earlier days of Andy Burnham's premiership, it was there and thereabout, sometimes in the background. It was hard to really pin down exactly how far he wanted to go with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's been quite consistent in talking about this. When he was running to be an MP and when he first became Labour leader, as you said, he talked about ending 40 years of neoliberalism, which is a kind of, slightly academic term for kind of Thatcherism, really. I mean, it's that kind of shift where, our public services were privatised. And I think a lot of the British public realise now, and did at the time, actually, if you look at opinion polls from the time, that this wasn't good for them. And we've seen our bills go up. We've seen service levels decline, more pollution in our rivers and seas. And that's bad, and that's bad for business. It's bad for, consumers as well, because the cost of energy is affecting both businesses and consumers. It means people have got less money to spend going out in the shops, going out to the pub, going and having a meal in the restaurant. All those sort of things are compromised by the fact we are now paying more for our housing, we're paying more for our energy, more for our water bills that have gone up above inflation as well in recent years. So getting control of this is absolutely key to getting economic growth and getting people feeling a bit happier in their lives, having a bit more spending money, feeling content with politics again. I mean, that's a feeling we haven't felt for a long time, for decades probably, in this country, if you look at, how people feel about politics, whichever government's been in power in recent times. So I think it is really important he does this. And, it will be horses for courses, I think, as Simon said.
Where are the risks, do you think, Andrew, for Andy Burnham if he really decides to kick on with this?
I don't think there are particular risks. I mean, look, I think the risk is if he doesn't, if he gets bogged down in sort of, half-hearted measures and, is, perhaps caught up in legal wranglings over things. So how he does it is important. That is a risk, I guess, is making sure you do this in a way that's quite clean, that delivers results fairly quickly, because people haven't got a lot of patience for politicians at the moment. That's why we've had, my daughter's five, she's had five prime ministers. There's been this big turnover because people are frustrated with the state of the country. And unless he gets on with this and does it in full, boldly, I think he will be in trouble in the same way his predecessors were.
When you say there about things being quite clean, unfortunately for him, Thames Water, which will be the first big challenge, is not really the ideal sketchbook for that, is it?
No, there's a very difficult situation at the moment if the water companies are finally deemed to be failing. And by most people's conception, they've put up our bills above inflation. They're dumping record levels of, sewage into our rivers and seas. Most people would say, well, that's failing. Thames Water is also financially massively in trouble. And, you know, the regime of taking that back over is quite complicated at the moment. So what I expect we'll see is a law change similar to what happened, I think, when Railtrack was turned into Network Rail about 20 or so years ago now, so that it's made easier to do that. Because at the moment, it's not good for the public, it's not good for the government, it's not good for consumers, that the way this is carrying on. So okay. I think he'll have to change the law in order to do that.
Andrew Fisher, thank you very much.
18 minutes to 8. Four words said it all. Nothing left to give. The words of one of the greatest footballers of all time, Lionel Messi, as he announced he was hanging up his boots for Argentina yesterday, the same day that one of tennis's great champions, Novak Djokovic, who's the same age as Messi at 39, faced questions over how much longer he has left after he was knocked out of the first round of the US Open. It is hard, very hard, to know when to quit when you've poured so much into what you do from such an early age. Some sportsmen and women go out on their own terms, others push on even as the magic fades. Annabelle Croft, the former British tennis number one, is in New York for the US Open. She sent us these thoughts.
I don't think any athlete really knows when is exactly the right time to retire. It's very hard because it's like a rock star that doesn't want to get off the stage. And if you've been a great, great champion, you always feel that there's a chance that you can reignite what you created. Some players have announced it ahead of time and then had to spend the whole year with a victory tour and then answering press and media, you know, all the way through the year, and found that quite exhausting, and some have definitely regretted it. I think for Novak Djokovic, he's achieved so much in the sport. I think any of us can understand why he wants to continue on and see if he can keep igniting something just to get that potential last Grand Slam under his belt. But it does feel like everything is catching up with him now.
That was Annabelle Croft. Ellen White is a former England striker, Euro 2022 winner. She hung up her boots in 2022, now has a career in broadcast and media. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning.
How hard was the moment for you?
I think it comes with a lot of thought. And obviously, you know, it was probably 6 to 9 months, but prior to the Euros, everyone's decision is very different in retiring. You know, some unfortunately have to retire due to injury. But I think for me, it was about taking it in my own hands and then having control over my own destiny and being able to retire on my own terms. And that's what obviously Lionel Messi has been able to do in his own terms and at the top. Obviously, it's unfortunate he wasn't able to win a second World Cup, but you can't dispute what he's done for Argentinian football. And he's just an absolute incredible legend and a superstar.
I mean, the contrast, of course, we drew earlier with Novak Djokovic having this terrible time at the US Open, knocked out in the first round, and the vomiting and the pain. I mean, how important do you think is going out on a high?
It's really difficult. Obviously, that is the dream, to go out on a high, yeah. Winning and being at your peak. That is the ultimate dream, obviously, to be able to do something you love. But when you do something that you love for so many years, and obviously it's your whole life, it's really hard to step away. And you want to continue to be able to compete at the very, very top. And Novak Djokovic's been able to do that for so many years, you know, Wimbledon and getting to so many finals and winning so many Grand Slams. So it's really challenging when you are still competing, but then you are suffering maybe with some injuries and obviously being knocked out in the first round. It is absolutely heartbreaking. So only the person themselves know when it's the time to actually retire or to stop. But that is the challenge, being able to overcome that and being able to actually say, no, it is time to actually stop.
Does legacy play a part in the decision, the thought that there may be one more trophy, one more record?
Yes. Definitely, I think for those that are definitely at the top and have experienced that and experienced winning and what that feels like, it's very hard to replicate that in any form of life as an athlete. So that is such a high, and you're driven by that. You're driven by wanting to win and wanting to be at the top. So that is a massive pull and a massive drive for those athletes. And I can imagine Messi, it was for to go and win the World Cup again. So that was a huge, obviously, drive for him to do one more. And it was so close to it as well. So I'm sure that is something that is constantly ticking away, being like, can I do another 4 years? Can I do another Grand Slam? But it takes its toll.
Ellen, who had the joy of going out on a high yourself, didn't you, after the Lionesses won Euro 2022? Ellen White, thank you very much indeed. It is 13 minutes to eight. It's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is the writer Ridian Brooke.
Good morning. The British Museum has announced record ticket sales for the upcoming Bayeux Tapestry exhibition, and London is expecting an imminent invasion of thousands of people from different nations. In a piece of cultural rapprochement, the French are loaning us the 70-metre embroidery for 9 months. President Macron has joked that the delicate negotiations took longer than Brexit. The Bayeux Tapestry is such a part of the collective memory, I still think of it as if having been in this country for the last 1,000 years, rather than in France. In my schoolboy head, history began at the Battle of Hastings. This owes something to 1066 and all that, which says, the Norman conquest was a good thing, as from this time onwards England stopped being conquered and was thus able to become top nation. Growing up amongst the castles of Pembrokeshire, we would joke that they were built by the Norman oppressors. Secretly, I thought they were magnificent, and part of my own heritage, mongrel Welshman that I am. Last year, I saw the tapestry in Bayeux the week before it was dismantled to be sent to England. I had just visited the memorial sites of another great invasion on the beaches of Normandy, from D-Day to Doomsday. In the flesh, the tapestry is a piece of embroidered cinema, the IMAX of its day, that grips from the first metre to the 70th. Commissioned by the conquerors, but stitched by the conquered, it clearly depicts an invasion of subjugation rather than liberation, showing the trauma of rape, torture, as well as the intensity of battle. Victory and defeat are closely woven, and it is hard to tell the Saxons and Normans apart. What the tapestry shows, like the arrows in maps indicating Angles and Saxons and Normans invading these shores, is that history is not as neat as we would have it, and we're not as pure or top nation as we like to think. This is nothing new. As the psalmist says, O God, the nations have invaded our inheritance. And the invaders kept coming, Assyrians, Babylonians, Romans, and on and on. The prophets saw these invasions as God's way of disciplining a disobedient people who thought they were top nation, and they called on God to intervene. Some believe this cry was answered when God, in the person of Christ, invaded history. This was done without the use of chainmail or weapons. The Gospels depict it as a sort of hidden invasion, a rapprochement, where the conqueror comes to do battle with the forces that kill. Defeat and victory are so closely woven in this history that it's hard to be sure who wins and who loses. If, however, we look closely enough in the detail of seeming defeat, we can still find the threads of a divine artistry and love.
That was Thought for the Day with the writer Ridian Brooke. And Nick will be swapping the Today studio for the slightly grander surrounds of the British Museum on Thursday morning to kick off Radio 4's Norman Day.
It's 10 to 8. The Office for Students is today launching a new complaint scheme, which it hopes will resolve the concerns of members of university staff and visiting speakers who feel their right to free speech and academic free expression have been infringed. One of those is Dr. Kevin Ewell, an emeritus professor at the University of Sunderland. He's a campaigner against assisted dying, or assisted suicide, as he calls it, and was warned about his words by the University of Sunderland. I began by asking him what the university said.
There had been a complaint, and it asked me to reflect carefully about my tone and nature of my social media presence. It told me nothing else apart from that. There was no detail of what the complaint was about, of who made it, of why they made it, of anything. So it was just this sort of Kafkaesque complaint that I received. Basically, the complaint, when you read it, objected to me saying that assisted dying was assisted suicide, and calling it Orwellian to say anything else. But I've been dealing with controversial topics for a long time. And so I'm used to getting specious complaints, but just not the university having to react to them in that way.
I mean, the university says that they were making you aware of a complaint, but that they weren't going to take it further. They didn't ask you to stop campaigning, just to make a clear distinction between your personal views and the university to which you are connected. And they say they didn't ask you to alter your views. What is your complaint against their complaint?
Well, simply that they should have thrown it out. And it was more that they said, you know, you need to reflect carefully about what your tone and nature is. And so to me, it was like getting a yellow card for something that I had no idea exactly what I've done. And I think the university is out of order for trying to sort of clamp down on any kind of controversial views. That's what a university should actually be supporting.
Would you take this kind of issue to the new Office for Students' Complaints scheme? I mean, are you heartened by the creation of the scheme? Is it something that you think will help?
I hope so. I would have done that. Obviously, it's just come into play today, so yeah. I didn't do that. I didn't know what to do until somebody suggested that I go to the Campaign for Academic Freedom and ask them about it. And see whether I was being reasonable and being a little bit irritated by the whole thing. But yes, I would certainly use the OFS scheme.
Dr. Kevin Yule, thank you very much. Well, listening to that is Professor Arif Ahmed, the Director for Freedom of Speech and Academic Freedom at the Office for Students. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can we talk first of all about how the scheme will work? How would someone like Dr. Yule use it?
Yes, thank you. So the scheme, which opens today, is a scheme for academics, visiting speakers, members of staff at universities and colleges. And if you've been, for instance, stopped from saying something, suppose that you want to do research and a foreign country doesn't like it, or you're a visiting speaker and you've been cancelled and your speech is controversial and people don't like it, you absolutely have the right to do that research and to express it. And if an institution has unlawfully stopped you from doing that, you can now bring a complaint directly to us, the Office of Students, the regulator. You'd have to go through your internal process first, but then you can bring it to us after a certain amount of time. We would look at the complaint. We would decide whether the institution has met its free speech duties and whether it's upheld your legal rights. We would take a view on that. If we found that it hadn't, we would then make a recommendation as to what it ought to do. For instance, reinstate the research, reinstate the visiting speaker, amend its policy, issue an apology, a range of things that might happen if we found that the complaint was justified. And we would also expect to publish our findings.
The Office for Students took a pretty brutal battering recently from the courts in a case involving the University of Sussex. It essentially said that the OFS was biased in the way it came to a decision about free speech on a trans and non-binary equality policy. Are you convinced the OFS is the right body to run the scheme?
I think there's a couple of things I'd say about that. So the first thing is that obviously we've accepted the findings of the court and we've reflected very deeply on what the judge had to say in that particular case. We're doing a lessons learned exercise and we'll be saying in more detail about that very shortly. And we're changing our processes. We're thinking about how to address those very important points that you raise. With regards to freedom of speech in particular, I'll say a couple of other things about that. The first thing is that the duties and the rights that underpin this new complaint scheme come from new legislation, and they come from duties and rights that came into place after we'd begun the investigation, indeed after we'd concluded the investigation into the University of Sussex from 2021 onwards. And we have also updated our own guidance in relation to freedom of speech following the judge's comments. And we published that new guidance. And it continues to offer strong protections for free speech and academic freedom for academics, visiting speakers and so on.
You will, under the new scheme, I believe, have the power to fine universities, won't you? I mean, up to £500,000 or 2% of their income, possibly call for public money to be withheld. I mean, you must see this as a pretty significant problem to be looking at that level of punishment.
I think there's two things there. So the first thing is that we are expecting to put in place, in addition to this scheme, we are expecting to put in place new requirements on universities, new conditions of registration, as they're called, from April of next year. And it will be in connection with those that we will have our normal powers, which include, as you say, for instance, fines and the cutting off of public money in especially egregious cases. Though in many cases, and in relation to this complaint scheme, it may be, and obviously in a lot of cases, our preference would be to resolve things sooner, wherever that's possible. Sure. In terms of the seriousness of the issue, however, I would say that our own research shows, for example, that one in five academics say that they are afraid to discuss controversial issues in their teaching, that this is significantly higher for women, significantly higher for non-white ethnic minorities amongst academics, and that amongst the 20% who say they're afraid to discuss controversial issues, one in four say that it's because they fear physical violence. So we do think that there is a significant issue. Just as an example of some anecdotal things, of the sorts of things that we've heard about academics, for instance, who feel under threat, for instance, from pressure from foreign countries, academics who feel afraid to express things because their institution wants to retain a relationship with those countries, academics who've been subject to death threats. And the threats also fall, we would expect, on, for instance, academics who are in precarious positions. So those, for instance, who are in short-term contracts, the threat of even minor sanctions for what they say can be enough to stop them talking in the first place. Well, and it's that chilling effect, which is obviously of great concern if you think about the whole point of what universities and colleges are for.
We will leave it there. Professor Arif Ahmed, thank you very much for coming on the programme today. Thank you.
Let's check the weather. Here's Helen Willetts.
Anna, thanks very much indeed. So a day of sunny spells and showers again in the south, more general rain in the north. So for England and Wales, we have had quite a bit of sunshine to start this morning, but the cloud will tend to build up through the day. We will have a scattering of showers. There are one or two around this morning, but they won't be as extensive or indeed as intense as recent days. So we've got a window of drier weather for many parts of England and Wales today. There's more rain, welcome rain, of course, on the way as we move into tomorrow. Temperatures 20 to 23 degrees Celsius. So still warm. It's the first day of the meteorological spring, of course, today, but the sun's still strong. Northern Ireland have a rain band moving in on a breeze, which will push that rain across many parts by the end of play today, 17 or 18 the high here. And to Scotland, also we have that wet weather. It's moving into the western side of the central lowlands at the moment. It's pretty heavy northwest of the Great Glen. It'll push its way southwards, clear from the north, but hang around in the south. 17 or 18 today.
Thank you, Helen. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
It's 8 o'clock on Tuesday, the 1st of September. The headlines: Andy Burnham is to make his first Commons statement as Prime Minister, with questions looming about prison places and the cost of living. We'll speak to Chris Mason and the Justice Secretary after the news. A former gang boss has been found guilty of ordering the murder of the rapper Tupac Shakur 30 years ago. And a man has been charged with murder following a house fire in Middlesbrough last week, which killed a 7-year-old girl and her aunt.
Coming up in the next hour of the programme, our correspondent inside Nepal reports on how rescuers are trying to blast into tunnels where around 600 workers are trapped. Fresh from winning gold at the European Championships, British sprint star Dina Asher-Smith on the search for a triumphant final chapter.
Being able to have a London World Championships, and I think a lot of athletes would be looking to have a little swan song at that one, it would be a beautiful way to round off a career.
And should children be taught more about the wonder and power of smell? We'll hear the case for following our noses. But first, the BBC News is read by Caroline Nicholls.
Andy Burnham is preparing for his first parliamentary appearance as Prime Minister, where he's expected to tell MPs he wants to create a sense of optimism in Britain. Mr. Burnham is scheduled to meet his cabinet this morning before heading to the House of Commons to face questions. The Conservatives and Reform UK are expected to demand more details about how the Prime Minister will pay for the policies he's announced so far. Our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, reports.
Andy Burnham has been in office for 6 weeks now, but we've never seen him in Parliament as Prime Minister. In fact, it's 16 years since he's appeared in the Commons as a minister. In his first outing today, Mr. Burnham will seek to describe the broad direction his government will take, focusing in particular on two areas. He will talk about his desire to secure stronger public control of essential services, and he will offer more detail on Number 10 North, explaining how he hopes it will fundamentally reshape how the country is run. Perhaps the biggest difference that the Prime Minister hopes to establish with what came before is tonal. He will promise a sense of optimism about Britain's future, saying that his programme for government will unlock a feeling of positivity and possibility in every part of the country. The Conservatives and Reform UK are questioning how new measures will be funded. The Greens say he should commit to bringing water and energy companies under full public ownership. And the Liberal Democrats have said his plans to tackle the crisis over prison places are inadequate.
The government says it will invest £110 million in building hundreds of new prison places in existing jails in England and Wales. Unused areas such as offices and laundries will be converted into cells as part of a plan to create more space. Nick Hardwick, who's a former chief inspector of prisons, told us that while these measures would make some difference, ministers needed to take more action.
There is a real danger here that the system will run out of space. And even with the measures the government is suggesting, if there was to be a prison riot that took some capacity out of the system, if there was to be disturbances that involved a sudden increase in the prison population, the system would collapse. It is a very dangerous situation and it requires a significant, substantial response.
A former gang leader has become the first person to be convicted over the notorious murder of the rapper Tupac Shakur, who was shot dead in Las Vegas in 1996. Dwayne Davis, who's now 63, had denied ordering the killing. Tupac Shakur was one of the biggest stars in rap music, and his shooting, as part of a feud, had been surrounded by rumours and conspiracy for years. Our correspondent, Shaima Khalil, has been following the case and sent this report.
Count one, murder with use of a deadly weapon. Guilty of first-degree murder with use of a deadly weapon.
Dwayne Davis showed no reaction as the guilty verdict was announced. The 63-year-old sat with a neutral expression before being led from the courtroom by officers. For more than 2 weeks, jurors heard from former gang associates, eyewitnesses and police detectives about Tupac's killing and what led to it. Prosecutors said Davis orchestrated the attack after Tupac and his entourage assaulted his nephew at a Las Vegas casino. They said he supplied the gun and repeatedly admitted his involvement in interviews and a memoir. His lawyer argued those accounts were fiction, told for fame and money, and said there was no physical evidence placing Davis at the scene. But the jury rejected the defense. Davis now faces a potential life sentence.
More than 1,000 people are now confirmed to have died across Nepal and Tibet in last week's flash flooding. Search operations are continuing on both sides of the border, with more than 4,000 people still missing. The Home Office says the number of migrants crossing the Channel in small boats this summer has fallen to a six-year low. Almost 7,500 people made the journey between June and August. The Home Office says joint action with France helped drive the fall, while Conservatives attribute it to bad weather. Dr. Madeline Sumption, the director of the Migration Observatory at Oxford University, has been assessing the figures.
The numbers of people coming over are still relatively substantial. If you look at the last 365 days or so, we're talking sort of 28, 29,000 people who've arrived in small boats. So the government will be keen to talk about the reduction, and there is reason to think its policies have contributed to that reduction. But these are not trivially small figures. There are still reasonably substantial numbers of people making the crossing.
A 23-year-old man has been charged with murder in connection with a house fire near Middlesbrough last week. A 7-year-old girl and her aunt were killed. Our correspondent, Lauren Moss, reports.
The fire broke out on Birchington Avenue, about 4 miles east of Middlesbrough, just after 5 o'clock on Wednesday morning. 34-year-old Natalie MacDonald and her niece Valentina Foster, who was 7, both died. 4 others were injured in what police have called a truly tragic incident. A 23-year-old man has now been charged with 2 counts of murder and will appear at Teesside Magistrates Court later today. A 31-year-old man who was arrested in connection was released without charge on Sunday.
Shares in the online fast fashion retailer Shein have fallen by around 10% in Hong Kong after its long-awaited stock market debut. The company's business model of rapidly producing and selling clothes from its factories in China has faced growing scrutiny in recent years. Archana Shukla has more.
Shane was once estimated to be worth almost $100 billion. Today, it's valued at roughly a quarter of that. The brand has been hugely popular, especially with younger shoppers, for one simple reason. The latest fashion trends, dirt cheap, shipped straight from its vast factory network in China. But now growth has slowed sharply, costs are rising, and competition is fierce. Add to that trade tensions. Both the US and EU have removed tax breaks on small parcel imports, hitting Shane right where it hurts, its ultra-low prices. When the stock opened trading today, it fell heavily but recovered some ground. This stock listing comes after failed attempts in New York and London, where regulators raised concerns about Shane's labour practices and environmental record.
The UN's refugee agency has welcomed Pakistan's decision to temporarily protect 16,000 Afghans from deportation on humanitarian grounds. Human rights groups warn many Afghans are at risk of serious harm if they're sent back to Taliban-ruled Afghanistan. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, has been to the main border crossing between Pakistan and Afghanistan at Torkham.
The UN calls it the largest cross-border movement in the world. Over the past 3 years, Pakistan and Iran have expelled more than 6 million Afghans. We saw entire families spanning generations at the border crossing, the elderly hobbling on crutches, the children toddling into another country, another hard life. Many Afghans told us they'd never set foot in Afghanistan before. Pakistan and Iran say they've mainly focused on undocumented Afghans, but the security sweeps are also targeting registered refugees, as well as those said to be at risk of serious harm if they return home.
New research suggests that most people in the UK think the care system that supports older and disabled people needs to be changed, but there's little agreement on how to pay for it. The polling was carried out by Ipsos for the Health Foundation charity. The Prime Minister has asked Baroness Louise Casey to publish plans for reforming the care system by next summer. Here's our social affairs editor, Alison Holt.
With reform of the care system in England high on the Prime Minister's agenda, the views of voters will be key to shaping plans. Today's research by the Health Foundation gathered the opinions of more than 2,200 people across the UK. 40% said standards of care were worse now than a year ago. A similar number wrongly believes social care was free at the point of need. Most care providers are privately run and for profit, but just 5% of people thought that was acceptable. Ideas on how to fund change range from a ring-fenced tax to cuts to other public services.
The Met Office will publish provisional figures this afternoon, which are expected to show that this summer was the UK's hottest since records began in 1884. That would break a benchmark set just last year. BBC Weather's Ben Rich explains.
It's been a summer of heat waves, drought and wildfires that has already broken records. Temperatures have reached or exceeded 30 Celsius somewhere in the UK on 40 days this year. The previous record was 34 days. An unprecedented 4 calendar months saw highs above 35 Celsius. Persistent areas of high pressure left some parts of southern England without rain for 2 months in the middle of the summer. However, wet weather at the start and end of the season in some areas means UK records for dryness are unlikely to be broken for the summer overall.
Ben Rich reporting.
Thanks very much, Caroline. It is 8:10. Many of the nation's children are returning to school this week. The nation's MPs are today returning to the Commons. Whether Andy Burnham has a new protractor and compass, we do not know, but we do know he'll give a statement to MPs setting out something of a statement of intent for his government. Opposite him will be, of course, Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch with a rather refreshed shadow cabinet by her side. Watching it all will be Chris Mason, our political editor, who joins us. Chris, Andy Burnham's no stranger to the Commons, but it's still a moment, isn't it? The dispatch box, the opposition arrayed in front of him as Prime Minister.
Yeah, morning to you, Johnny. Your protractor, your new pencil case, are looking sharp.
Very
and
shiny.
Dapper. I'm conscious our Scottish listeners thinking, what took you? Because, of course, summer holidays ended
a little week or two ago.
But, yeah, plenty reaching that crunching point of autumn dawning. And, yeah, for the Prime Minister, quite a moment, this, because it's been something of a soft launch, hasn't it, for Andy Burnham? Just a coincidence of the calendar, really, becoming Prime Minister at just the point that Parliament vanished into its lengthy summer recess. So a big moment today, effectively an accumulation of all of the moments that might otherwise have happened over the summer had Parliament been sitting. So he'll be in the Commons perhaps for a couple of hours. It'll be a broad conversation because there's been these peppering of relatively small but eye-catching policy ideas over the summer. It'll be the first time we get a sense of the tone that he tries to strike. The emphasis again and again and again from his team has been one of wanting to be positive and upbeat. In other words, learning the lessons of those early months of Keir Starmer, which were tonally the opposite. And then how does he interact with both his political opponents across the chamber and indeed his own MPs behind him? And how do they, his political opponents, Kemi Badenoch, Nigel Farage and Ed Davey and others, how do they interact with him? It'll be fascinating to observe.
And beyond the drama of today, there's the business of government to come, isn't there? Mm. And the challenges of government did not just disappear with the disappearance of Keir Starmer.
Exactly. So let me give you a sense of the sort of arc of the political autumn from the Prime Minister's perspective. There's this afternoon's session, then there's his first Prime Minister's questions tomorrow. Looks like he'll be off to the UN General Assembly in New York in a couple of weeks' time to meet Donald Trump and lots of other world leaders. Then he's his party conference speech in Liverpool at the end of the month. Budget after that, and then a 10-year plan he is promising around about November. You know, we've had quite a few Prime Ministers, Johnny, in the last few years entertain time frames, including the word decade. So let's see how this pans out. But that's what he is planning to do in November. And on the ledger, in terms of big, crunchy decisions, I mean, just sort of off the top of my head, oil and gas, the whole question of the Jackdaw gas field, the Rosebank oil field. There's noises about saying yes to that gas field off Aberdeen. There's the budget, there's the crunching decisions around defence spending. John Healey, the Chancellor, talking in an interview in the Times overnight, trying to push back on this suggestion that he's going soft on the very thing he demanded, i.e. 3% of GDP being spent on defence by 2030 when he resigned as Defence Secretary. The suggestion that he was going soft on it as Chancellor, he's saying he's going to set out more detail come the spending review next year. There's energy bills as we head into the autumn and winter. There's the welfare question. There is social care. Yeah, absolutely, Johnny, your central point. So many of the massive issues that caused so many problems for Keir Starmer are now sitting very firmly on Andy Burnham's desk.
Opposite Andy Burnham, Kemi Badenoch with a refreshed shadow cabinet. Is the reshuffle going to make a difference? Do you understand what drove it?
Yeah, I think it was driven by a sense, Johnny, that Kemi Badenoch wanted to kick on from the team she'd assembled immediately after taking the leadership when the party was on its uppers, relying on sort of big-hitting, pretty well-known names from the previous Conservative government, not least Mel Stride and Priti Patel in two senior jobs which they were relieved of yesterday. This is about refreshing things with a bit of a sense of when might a general election come and what might the Conservative front bench look like at the time of the general election. What I can tell you this morning is the final piece in that reshuffled jigsaw is that Alex Burghardt has been appointed the deputy leader of the Conservative Party. He's going to continue as Shadow Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster and Shadow Northern Ireland Secretary. He became an MP in Essex, neighbouring the constituency of Kemi Badenoch, back up the same time in 2017. He will be the regular deputy when she's not around for PMQs or for any other sort of occasion where you need somebody else to stand in for you. So yeah, I think the aim is to try and project a newer and fresher feel, and they're certainly emphasising, they've been leaning heavily on economics and that sense of trying to reclaim the mantle of economic credibility. This economic unit, as they call it, of the new Shadow Chancellor, Andrew Griffith, Claire Coutinho on business and Richard Fuller as the Shadow Chief Secretary of the Treasury, a sense from Kemi Badenoch that when she was business secretary, she often felt detached from the things going on over the road in the Treasury. Businesses would come in and demand things of her and she couldn't deliver them. So the idea is you bring together this economic unit that tries to square that circle. What she's ultimately trying to do is haul the Conservatives' ratings as well as their own into a more positive space, because, my goodness, it's super competitive with Reform and with Labour and with the Conservatives, as well as the Liberal Democrats and Plaid and the SNP. Yes, party conference season is coming. I've just been looking at my diary, Johnny. I think I'm going to seven this year. It gets longer every single year, which tells you something about the smorgasbord of competitivity, if you like, in British politics.
Chris, I hope your shoes are polished and your tie is well knotted. Chris Mason, our political editor, thank you.
One of the biggest items in Andy Burnham's in tray is, as you were hearing there, making space in overcrowded prisons and dealing, of course, with the issues that have come from that, including the early release of some offenders. Well, this morning the government's announced more than £100 million will be spent on building new prison places in jails in England and Wales. These are existing prisons, and that money is coming from existing budgets. So what it will see is things like storage areas and laundry rooms turned into cells instead. Alex Norris joins us, Justice Secretary. Good morning.
Morning, Anna. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for talking to us. We've been talking about the back-to-school theme this morning, but obviously you were tasked with basically giving up your holiday to do this at short-term over the holidays, which I suppose raises questions about the level of detail that has gone into this. So that's what I'm curious to find out a bit more about this morning. How many extra prison cells will be created as a result of this £110 million that you're announcing today?
Well, Anna, let's first remember where we've been on this journey. This has been a prison crisis created by our predecessor Tory government that's run for years and years. We're making really important changes that come into effect in the next few weeks through the Sentencing Act. Now, that does mean that some offenders will leave earlier than they were originally intended to. Already out of scope of that were murderers and terrorists. We took out earlier in the month those who committed rape offences, child sex offences, and as the Prime Minister said over the weekend, we've gone further with those who've taken life. And to do so, part of that is creating extra capacity. So, you know, the announcement we're making today sits within a prison building process of building 14,000 extra places. The money that I'm committing to today is brought forward, is building places in the hundreds as part of that.
So when we say hundreds, are we talking about 200 or are we talking about 900? Because when prison places are so in short supply at the moment, that's a big difference. So can you narrow it down for us?
I wouldn't want to give you the final exact figure because, you know, some of that will depend on when we're actually on site and I'm doing the doing. I think we'll be landing somewhere, I suspect, in the middle there. But I have to say, that is really important capacity. That's allowed us to make the changes that we've made already. You know,
it's all important capacity, but I think the concern is that what you are announcing won't go far enough. So Andy Burnham has said, as you were laying out there, that that the early release will be cancelled for a variety of different prisoners. So how many extra prisoners are you going to be holding as a result of that change that he announced?
That's 1,400. That's the 1,000 we announced earlier in August, 400 more from the weekend.
OK, and broadly 500 coming from this. So you're also looking at indeterminate sentences, which is a really tricky thing to deal with, isn't it? Are you planning to resentence people? How much of the work has been done to know how many of those people on indeterminate sentences for public protection you can actually release safely?
I mean, you know, Anna, I'd want to be clear, we're finding this capacity from a variety of spaces. It's the things
that I've brought
forward today.
Yeah, we're just working through them bit by bit,
Well, with regards to IPP sentences, it's been a long consensus across the political spectrum that those sentences are wrong. You know, there's been a reason why they were banned a number of years ago. I think listeners would be really surprised to hear that there are people sat in our prison, and for IPP sentences, 80% of them have served 10 more years than they were originally sentenced
to do. I think we know all of this. What I'm trying to find out from you is, to what level have you done the work to know how many of them can be released quickly to make this new promise from Andy Burnham happen?
Well, with regards to IPP prisoners, there's not going to be, you know, immediate quick releases as a result of the changes that we have announced. This is something that we're now looking at, not least because bringing IPP to an end requires legislation. So that is a journey, you know, that takes time in itself. So, you know, we're not solely reliant on IPP. People, of course, on those sentences do leave ordinarily through the parole process. But I'd want the public to understand from me directly that they're not going to see huge change here in the weeks and months ahead.
Well, so we are struggling then, aren't we, for quick answers on this. And what about foreign prisoners being deported? Since you started this work, have any more, any new agreements been made with other countries to take back their prisoners? Because that is the only way it'll work, isn't it?
Well, I mean, no, that's not quite right, Anna, in that this is one of the major changes that we've brought in over the last couple of years that we haven't had access to, but we now have access to. You know, foreign offenders is going to be one of the things that provides us with that biggest impact on our capacity figures. You know,
So has something new happened on that in the last few weeks?
It has indeed. Well, it is about to happen in the next few days, in that the Sentencing Act gives us more flexibility with when we can remove foreign offenders. Now, we have made really big strides in the removal of foreign offenders, 41% increase in our 2 years in office. Now, what we have in the Sentencing Act is the ability to remove more foreign offenders more quickly, so more offenders.
But somebody has to take them back, don't they?
Agreed, but we have a bigger pool of people to go back to the countries that we ordinarily remove to. We work day in, day out to grow those agreements we've got. We would rather have, and I work on this again on a day-to-day basis, prisoner transfer arrangements so that those individuals are serving the rest of their sentence. In many cases, that's not possible, so those individuals are being removed as foreign offenders, and that will be then the responsibility of the receiving country.
And is that still going to happen? Because that raises big questions, doesn't it, about whether or not justice is being served, if people are being returned to a different country where they're then simply freed?
Yeah, that is a really important question, and one that I suspect will play out on the programme in the weeks and months ahead. So we will essentially have the ability under the Sentencing Act to remove a foreign offender without having served any of their sentence, essentially at conviction. Now, it's likely they may well have served time on remand, but there is an important question that you pose there, Anna, about what justice is and isn't in those cases. That's why, and I'll be setting full detail out to Parliament later, subject to the Speaker's consent, that we will be taking offenders out of scope of that immediate removal in line with what we've done with regards to the Sentencing Act. So again, murderers, terrorists, those who've committed rape offences, child sex offences, those who've taken life. But I do think, and it's really important...
I want to understand, and I want our listeners to understand as well. So you're saying that people who've committed the most serious offences, they will not be removed to a foreign country if you don't have the guarantee that they will be in jail when they get there?
We will be not changing from what we do at the moment, which, as I say, at the moment we remove 30% of sentence. We won't be changing from that. But I want people to understand this, because this is really crucial, Anna, that I strongly defend a principle, and our view as a government is that removal from the country is in itself a very, very significant penalty. It's removal and inability to come back.
I'm not sure that will work with all victims, though, will it? To say we're removing them from the country, but they won't serve the sentence that they were given in a British court.
I agree, and that's conversations I have with victims and victims' advocates. But that is why, you know, we're not making changes to what we do in the case of particularly serious offences.
I just want to play this. Mark Fairhurst, the National Chair of the Prison Officers Association, someone you'll deal with on a regular basis, he says that another of the issues that you have is that it's not just as simple as creating more capacity.
Who's going to staff the new prisons? If you create additional space, you need additional staff. Where are these staff coming from? Because we can't retain staff. The working conditions, well, the workplace is too violent. The wages are too low. And the retirement age is too high. Nobody wants to become a prison officer these days. We've got hundreds of staff who are ferried all across the country to shore up prisoners that can't recruit staff. That's costing about £1 million per week to put staff up in hotels and pay their travel expenses. So create as much space as you like. Where's all the extra staff coming from?
What's the answer to that, Alex Norris?
Well, first of all, I want to recognise the crucial work that our prison officers do, and indeed the Prison Officers Association do great work in advocating for their members. Staffing is at the heart of everything we do, both in prison and probation. So whether it's the improvements we've made in public sector pay in recent years, retention is absolutely crucial. But I'd want him to hear, and his members to hear, you know, we are making immediate term changes to make sure that those who've taken lives aren't leaving earlier under the progression model. I think they would share that. But this is are not the end state for our prisons. Prisons are running very hot. That means that the regime is much stricter. It means that things are tenser, exactly as he says. We are going to get out of this doom loop, much longer arc. That's why we're going to do more
but
building.
But he asked you where the extra staff were coming from.
Well, retention is the primary thing. The most important thing I can do, because we are always adding, and I would encourage people listening to enter into prison officer service as a career, but retaining our current staff. And, you know, I will have important conversations with him, I have no doubt, around pay, terms and conditions, health and safety to come. But, you know, we will improve that prison environment so that, you know, people want to stay as well, but so that it's the best possible place to work in what is a very, very difficult job.
Alex Norris, the Justice Secretary, thanks for joining us this morning.
It's 26 minutes past 8. This week we'll see the official unveiling of the Bayeux Tapestry at the British Museum. It's the first time the tapestry has been in the UK in almost a millennium. We'll be broadcasting from the museum on Thursday morning. Nick is the lucky man to be doing that on part of Radio 4's Norman Day. In the run-up, we wanted to ask some familiar voices for their reflections on the tapestry and the most famous battle in British history. Here's the Anglo-French author Joanne Harris, best known for her 1999 novel, Chocolat, sharing her thoughts on what the tapestry means to people on both sides of the Channel.
One of the things that has always lingered in my mind is how very familiar some of those places are, because my entire French family is from Brittany, and there are just places that I recognised even as a child. There's Paul, there's Dinan, there's Rennes, and there's the Mont Saint-Michel, where Harold rescues some of William's men from the quicksand. And these were all stories. They were all places that I knew already, and so I felt a sense of ownership, if you like, and of belonging to it. I first saw it when I was about 7 in Bayeux with my mother and my French grandfather, and I was very struck by it. I think it's, to a small child, it seems quite a familiar format. It's like a comic strip. It has recognisable characters. And then when I was a teacher, I took several school trips to France when I taught at a boys' school in Yorkshire. And we revisited the tapestry, and I became more interested in it and found more to discover every time. And talking with the boys about it, I got their responses too. Some of them wanted to look at the bawdy images and know what they meant. Lots of them wanted to ask questions. I couldn't answer them all because the tapestry is full of unanswered questions, which is, I think, one of the things that makes it so intriguing. Because my heritage is divided, it makes perfect sense that the tapestry's heritage should be divided and that it should be claimed quite passionately by both sides. Of course, it belongs to both sides. Its history belongs to both sides. It's not just something that exists in isolation. It's part of a long and complicated dialogue of historians and folklorists over centuries, and that's just as it should be.
The author Joanne Harris, and as I mentioned, we will be presenting from the British Museum on Thursday.
Time for the sport. Here's Jonathan.
Morning again. Unlike Novak Djokovic yesterday, Carlos Alcaraz, Naomi Osaka and Iga Swiatek all won their US Open first round matches in New York last night. Britain's Harriet Dart and Jacob Fernley also had a good payday, earning themselves £100,000 for winning their opening matches. The Wimbledon semi-finalist Arthur Ferry and fellow Brit Jan Choinski will attempt to do the same when they play later today. Coverage on BBC Sounds. We wait to hear if Djokovic will continue playing after such a distressing defeat. Lionel Messi announced yesterday he'd retired from international football, but there's no sign that the British sprinter Dina Asher-Smith has plans to slow down. In fact, far from it. As much as Amy Hunt becoming the first athlete to win 4 gold medals at one championship last month in Birmingham, the record books show that Dina Asher-Smith has won an unprecedented 11 medals at the European Championships, 8 golds, 3 bronzes, and she's just been telling me how her ambition for more track success over the next few years burns as brightly as ever.
Well, thank you for bringing it up again. But honestly, I think I'm a bit strange in that regard where I don't think about it too much. Like, obviously, I'm here, I'm talking about it, I'm really excited, and thank you so much for having me. But I'm definitely somebody where my mum, who is a big fan of all of the BBC shows, is like, oh, Dina, please go on this TV. Like, please, 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 please. Because I'm somebody who would just go and lie on a beach, kind of move on and then look at what I can improve and how I can do better next season. So I think quite rightfully I've been pushed to celebrate it and basking it a bit, which I'm grateful for all those people around me that are nudging me towards that.
But if you're the most decorated athlete in European Championship history, how much does that drive you on? That must do something for your motivation, doesn't it?
Definitely. I think I definitely would be very inspired to see if I could push it a bit further. So making sure that as much as is sensible in Olympic year, in the next 2 years, I would hopefully look to win a few more medals at this championships. But ultimately, I think it's also a point where I'm just really happy. And I think that's strange to say as an athlete. And I'm so guilty of this, where you're always pushing, always pushing. But when I started, and probably started in 2014, and was very upset that I tore my hamstring in the 200, and then the next championship I won in 2016, to say that 10 years later I'll be sitting here as the most decorated in the history of the competition, I wouldn't really think that could happen, mainly because so many things could have gone wrong along the way. Like in track and field, you could be walking down the street, you step off the curb wrong, you roll your ankle, that could be your career done. So I think when I look back and I think to the girl in 2014, 2016, or even the 8-year-old who watched the Olympics and decided she wanted to be a runner, I think I would just be really proud. It does motivate me always, because I've got high standards for myself, but I think I'm also allowing myself to just be a bit like, yeah, you did that. I'm really happy for you. What a successful career so far.
I'm not surprised. And you're not just successful at sport, because you've got academic success. And what's interesting about your group of sprinters is that so many of you have been to university. You're a history graduate. You've got Amy Hunt, who's an English graduate. Imani Lansico does psychology, or did psychology with you at the King's College London. You've got Success, who's a midwife too. How does that help? How do those two worlds collide to produce such high achievers?
I've always been surrounded by lots of women who were very capable and very well-rounded. And I think I can only speak for myself, obviously, but I think that it gives you a lot of context. And kind of doing history, it's a bit morose, but I was constantly just surrounded by statistics of wars, of deaths, of cultural movements, of disease, of famine. And I would be processing that every day and just learning from it and writing arguments and understanding what happened and how in the future we could avoid those things. And then when I go onto a track, and the hardest thing in my life is how fast I get from A to B, it does give me a beautiful sense of context. Like, even if I'm getting wound up and I'm getting stressed, or the race or the run or the training session did not go the way I expected, I always remember that it is a luxury that me in 2026, this is the most pressing thing about my day. And I think kind of studying history really hit home, really solidified that for me. So I've just been always grateful throughout my career. It's kept me very grounded, very stuck in reality, where, yeah, it's great that I run 100 metres in whatever and 200 in whatever, but when it's a bad day, like, it's still a blessing that your bad day is if you came second or you didn't run as fast as you wanted to.
Thinking of history in contrast, how excited for the future are you? Merlin Otte was competing at 52. You're 30. World Championships next year, Olympics in 28.
I don't know if I'm going to be competing until I'm 52. I remember I competed at the Merlin Otte Stadium when I was in Slovenia. Like, she's a Jamaican icon. She's an icon across so many different nations in track and field. I think it's incredible that she competed until 52, but I don't see that for myself. I'm excited for next year. I'm excited for LA, and I'm fingers crossed for also for a home world championships in 2029. I think it's stuck in the bidding process for that, and being able to have a London world championships, and I think a lot of athletes would be looking to have a little swan song at that one. It would be a beautiful way to round off a career.
Dina Asher-Smith, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. Fascinating. Stay well.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I hope you have a great morning.
Same to you. Let's feed off her energy, shall we? Dina Asher-Smith, BA history. And just to say, athletics Diamond League season comes to a conclusion on Friday night. Coverage on BBC Two from 7. Amy Hunt and Keely Hodgkinson both qualified to run.
Jonathan, you are well fed with her energy. Thank you very much indeed. Just after 9 this morning on Radio 4, our transatlantic journey concludes.
I'm David Dimbleby. I've reported on America for decades.
The United States, whatever our faults may be, is the hope of the world.
America seen as the head of the free world. And yet today, that idea is in crisis.
From the History Podcast, Invisible Hands, The American Century.
The story of how the United States became a superpower at the head of a new global order. And the invisible hands that guided it.
Listen first on BBC Sounds.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And at 25 to 9, Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
Andy Burnham is preparing to face MPs for the first time as Prime Minister as Parliament returns from its summer break. He's expected to say he wants to decentralise power and unlock a feeling of positivity. The government says it will invest £110 million, creating hundreds of new prison places in existing jails across England and Wales. The money will come from existing budgets and be used to convert spaces, including storage areas and laundry rooms, into cells. The Justice Secretary, Alex Norris, told this programme the investment would create hundreds of prison places, but could not give an exact figure. A former gang leader has been found guilty of the murder of the American rapper Tupac Shakur almost 30 years after his death. A jury in Las Vegas convicted 63-year-old Dwayne Davis of first-degree murder. Nepal's Prime Minister has said last week's devastating flash floods weren't an ordinary event, but were driven by climate change. More than 1,000 people are confirmed to have died in the flash flooding in Nepal and Tibet, with 4,500 people still missing.
Thanks very much, Caroline. It is 24 minutes to nine. Between January and May this year alone, water companies in England and Wales discharged raw sewage into rivers and seas during dry weather 7,280 times. 7,280 times, they say. The number for all of last year, 8,576. The suggestion then, the number for the whole of this year is going to be hugely up on last year, and that such dry day spills are becoming more and more common. Those figures were first reported in The Guardian. They were extracted in a Freedom of Information request from Rob Forrester, a former Environment Agency employee and whistleblower who joins us now. Rob, the point about dry spills is that the reason or the excuse for many sewage discharges is that they are the result of storms and storm overflows, and that spills that happen in dry periods have no such excuse. Have I got that right?
Good morning. Yeah, that's right. Normally, sewage dumping falls under the guise of wet weather, can be hid behind the rainfall. There's no rainfall at all involved in dry spills except minuscule amounts. So that excuse goes out the window.
So why are companies discharging in dry periods?
It appears to be a policy to get rid of as much sewage as possible untreated, whether it's quotas, whether it's profit margins. It shouldn't be happening, because if you've not got the infrastructure to treat raw sewage, then we'd be having raw sewage dumps every single day. It'd just be continuous. So it does seem to be a policy to dump sewage, whatever the weather.
And by dumping sewage rather than processing it, you save money if you're a water company. Is that right?
That's right. You save money. You save money in treating the sewage. The difference in dry weather as well is that the receiving waters are a lot more sensitive because of the low flows. So environmentally more sensitive, public health a lot more sensitive because people are using them to swim in, to use activities in. So more caution should be used in dry weather, but the opposite appears to be true.
I mean, if the figures do represent dry discharges, and I should say the water industry has said that the figures are unverified, it's too early to describe them yet as dry spills, but if they are, then the suggestion is that there'll be many, many more dry discharges this year than last. I mean, maybe as many as double. Why would that be?
Well, just on the figures, the verification, to explain that these are figures submitted by the water company themselves to the Environment Agency. So that's their own admission that these are verified figures. They're the final count. Why it's happening more this year would suggest because it's been a drier year. And so there's more opportunity for dry spills to occur. But again, because of the dry weather, we should be seeing a reduction in spills, because you should be able to treat raw sewage. Yeah. It shouldn't be an excuse to dump it onto some sort of quota system.
And again, that would be, in your eyes, a saving for the water companies if they do these dry discharges.
Yeah, absolutely, because they're saving money instead of treating it. And the figures show just how high the level of criminality is to make that profit.
Rob, thank you very much for joining us. That was Rob Forrester, a former Environment Agency employee. We did ask for a representative of the water industry to come on the programme. They declined to offer one and instead pointed us towards the statement that they'd given the Guardian newspaper.
It is 20 to 9. A bit of breaking news for you. A British activist who was arrested in the occupied West Bank after being forcibly detained by Israeli settlers has now been deported to the UK. The Foreign Office says it's raised the case of Finch, often with the Israeli authorities. He's a 22-year-old student at the LSE. He was arrested in Omelkhair on Saturday after those settlers advanced on the Palestinian village. We can speak to Inbar Shakir Jacob Vardy, who's Mr. Joffin's lawyer. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Just tell me, he is now back in the UK. What conversations have you had with the Foreign Office here about what happened and about what they are going to be saying to the Israeli government about it?
I've been in contact with the British consulate in Israel, mostly regarding Finn's well-being. I'm sure other contact was made by the Foreign Office, but not through me.
And tell us about the incident, because there was a claim that he had assaulted someone, but he was there in the village and he said he was protecting Palestinians from a settler incursion, of which we've seen many in the last few weeks. Just tell us exactly what happened.
Well, the videos show very clearly what happened. Finn was in the village of Umm al-Khair, a village that is under constant attack from settlers which currently surround the village. And settlers continued to attempt invading the village of Umm al-Khair on Saturday. Finn, as part of the protective presence that he was in the village to do, stood next to the fence, which the settlers were trying to dismantle in order to keep it in place. He was holding on to the fence while children from the settlement tried to push past him in order to enter the village illegally. During this time, settlers started claiming that he was assaulting the child, even though he was standing still while the child were pushing onto him. It's important to mention that the Israeli police did not interrogate Finn on this suspicion. The Israeli police interrogated Finn only on the suspicion of common assault, and this is due to a false complaint from the settlers. This is a wide phenomenon that happens, that settlers file false complaints against activists in order to discourage them from their activism in the West Bank.
I'm just looking at what the police in Israel have said about this. They've talked about continuing to exercise their authorities in cooperation with various security agencies to thwart and prevent incidents of friction and violence. Have you been told whether or not there will be any ongoing charges against Finn, or is this the end of the matter as it's been described to you?
So far, we have not received an official decision to close the case, but usually in cases where international activists are deported after being interrogated once by Israeli police, no further charges are made, and the cases are often closed. Again, because this is a wide phenomenon, this is part of a policy by the Israeli police to discourage activists from assisting Palestinians in the West Bank. Again, continuing the policy of ethnic cleansing in the West Bank.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in fact, several Israeli politicians have started putting out statements about this. He said that he strongly condemned not this specific incident. He was talking about the criminal acts of violence committed in the villages of Kuzra and Jalud by what was described as a handful of rioters who are violating the law. But the issue of Israeli settlers and attacks on Palestinians and on Palestinian land is now becoming a more global issue. When we see these rejections of violence by Israeli politicians, do you think it will change things?
No, I think Israeli politicians make these statements in order to distract from the real issue. If we frame this as an issue of a few violent people, we are distracting from the fact that the settlements in the West Bank are part of Israel's policy. The attempt to make the West Bank Jewish and Israeli is part of this government's policy. This is something they encourage by allowing it to continue to happen, by the police arresting only activists who are attacked and not the people who kidnap them, like what happened to Finn. This is a policy. This is not a mistake. And for Israeli politicians to frame this as a mistake or as a specific instance of violence or crime by a specific radical group is misleading, and it is part of their attempt to allow the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank to continue.
Inbar Shaker Vardy, the lawyer to Finn Joffin, who, as we were saying, has been deported back to the UK. Thank you for joining us.
It's 9:15.
Now, let's talk about something a little different, because today's younger generation are apparently much lonelier than their predecessors, according to new research. Gen Z, which is roughly 15 to 29 year olds, are now five times more likely to say that they don't have any close friends. Back in 2014, only 1 in 100 people who were asked that question said they didn't have any close connections. But now it's 1 in 20. And the IPPR, which is behind this research, says that is making young people more distressed and less productive. It's having a real impact not having those close friends, those close connections anymore. Let's talk to the presenter of the documentary Generation Lonely, Tegan Marlowe, and also James Telfer, who is the founder of Circle Up, a social platform for people in their 20s and 30s to meet others. Good morning, both.
Morning.
Good morning.
Tegan, to you first of all, when you started talking to people of that generation, what were they saying to you? Were they telling you why they didn't feel like they had close friends anymore?
Yeah, I think there's quite a few factors that come into it. There are definitely a few common factors across them all. The main one, of course, being social media and everyone being so much more online now. You know, they're not going out and making friends in the real world as much as, you know, we did previously. And I think another big factor that came into it was the pandemic, because we have to remember that a lot of these young people, the pandemic happened right in those formative years for them when they were at school or university, and it kind of stopped them. It kind of really affected them at those crucial points of socialisation.
So, James, when you try and get people together then, is there a nervousness about even thinking about socialising when you haven't had that practice, I suppose, that Tegan was describing?
Yeah, I think definitely we do get a lot of people who turn up and the first time they can be quite, you know, nervous walking into a room full of people they don't know. But I think often what's really interesting is that once you start getting into conversations and you realise everyone's in the same boat, you know, I find that humans just ease into it, really, and it just becomes quite natural. So it's really the fear around those interactions, I think, that's a bigger problem than actually the interactions themselves.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So how do we deal with that, Tegan? Because obviously there are things that are being done, as James was describing there, but when you're sort of looking for something like that and you maybe can't find it, what's a good way to start?
Yeah, I think what James has described is a great solution. I think as much as social media can be a cause of the problem, it can also be the solution. So I think a lot of young people now are turning to social media to find these real life connections, these real life groups like the one James has amazingly set up. I also think, you know, workplaces that are predominantly more online now, obviously that's a very common thing that's causing the issue as well. I think they can maybe do more to foster more in-person meetups and socials and trying to get those foster those friendships in person, because it is almost like a skill you have to learn as a young person, I think, going out there and putting yourself out there, and it doesn't always come naturally to everyone.
No, and I suppose, James, you know, in so many ways, social media, the internet, it's a tool where we can reach a much broader range of people, but then also it can end up narrowing our connections as well. There's an interesting piece in The Eye yesterday by Amber Middleton, a freelance health journalist, who noticed that friends aren't asking her for help or advice anymore, because they're going to ChatGPT instead, because they can get what they would consider to be a less judgmental and more scientifically accurate answer. And that doesn't do much for our connections either, does it?
No, definitely not. I think, you know, humans ultimately are social creatures. We need to be around other people. If you look at, you know, human evolution, we evolved to be in tribes. And, you know, is there any wonder why there's a loneliness epidemic when there's not really a tribe for the modern world that exists? And, you know, environments that really bring people together in the real world are becoming less common. But I do think there's a shift happening, and a shift in the direction of real life again. You know, the almost anti-AI at the moment.
Yeah, there's a lot to think about, isn't there? Thank you both. James Telfer, the founder of Circle Up, and Tegan Marlowe, who presents that documentary Generation Lonely.
It's 10 to 9. Rescuers in Nepal are using powerful explosives to try and blast into tunnels where hundreds of workers are trapped underground. They've been there since last weekend's devastating flash floods, which have now killed more than 1,000 people, with many more still missing. Our South Asia correspondent, Azadeh Mashiri, reports from the region.
We've been driving from the capital, Kathmandu, to one of the worst affected areas, the district of Rasua. What you're hearing are the winding, dizzying dirt roads up the mountains of northern Nepal. The roads have only recently opened up since the flood. They're muddy, and that's because of the rains. We've seen three bulldozers so far who have clearly been working on clearing these roads up. So this is our first chance to see the state of the villages there. That is the sound of crickets because it's now nighttime. We've been on the road for 6 hours and we've come to a full stop. We've been stuck here for about an hour, and that's because of the conditions of the roads. They're so muddy, they're windy, it's narrow, and so trucks carrying aid and relief supplies are paralysed here. Andrew, let's go see what's happening.
We're moving.
So we made it to the village of Dunche, and now, this morning, we're trying to make our way as close to the path of the flood, and the road I'm walking on has just cut off. It's now all silt and mud and debris, and yet the villagers tell me that this road used to go all the way round the mountains to the trading village of Siabrubisi. And yet, looking around, there's nothing left. And when I look at where the debris has fallen, the way the trees around me have been completely uprooted, the height and the power of that wall of water that day is very clear. A helicopter is arriving. It looks like it's dropping off a group of emergency workers. That's because on the other side of the Butikosi River, which flows under the road I'm on, there's an entrance to the Chileme hydropower tunnel. And there, villagers have told me there are 6 workers who are trapped. They're not sure they're alive, but clearly rescue operations are ongoing. Sadly, there are hundreds of workers trapped in tunnels across northern Nepal. A man has just arrived to look over the tunnel. His name is Konchul Bahadur Tamang, and he told me that he's a computer engineer at the Hydro Power Company and that he knows the people who are trapped inside that tunnel. He comes here every few days to see whether the rescue operations are having any luck.
When there is a flood or an earthquake, the tunnel is the only safe place to stay, but this time it wasn't safe. Rescuers have been able to get 90 meters inside, but they say there is a lot of mud and it's impossible to go in any further.
We're back at our hotel to meet Buddha Shrestha. He's the hotel manager's friend and was working in Timore when the flood hit. We've seen videos he's captured. And in them, you see Timor's leafy mountains covered in this terrifying haze. Water is swallowing up everything in its path. He told me one of his friends was badly injured, so he rushed to help him, but it was just too late.
So I tried to help him, but after like 20 or 30 minutes, he cried a lot, and then he died in my arms. And after he died, after 10 minutes, the helicopter arrived. Me and his uncle put him in the helicopter, but he was no more before the helicopter arrived.
It's evening now and the generator isn't working anymore, so it's pitch black. When I think back to this past day, as we've been driving and walking through these villages in Rasua, every single person we've met has lost someone. Some of them were caught in the flood themselves. It just feels like that day has completely changed these communities, and it's hard to imagine how long it will take them to recover.
Azadeh Mushiri reporting there. It's 9:06, and all eyes will be on the House of Commons today as Andy Burnham addresses MPs for the first time as Prime Minister, and Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch appears with her newly reshuffled shadow cabinet. The upsum might be a sense of optimism versus ready for battle. Let's talk to a couple of seasoned observers of politics and policy. Alva Reyes, political editor at The New Statesman. Fraser Nelson is former editor of The Spectator, now a columnist at The Times. Welcome to both of you. Alva, may I start with you? How important is Andy Burnham's performance in the Commons today?
Well, I mean,
I think he will have prepared quite a bit for this because he has had 6 weeks of not appearing in the Commons. So it's become a bigger moment than it maybe otherwise would have been. But I think it will just be really interesting, not just his performance in the Commons, where he's going to sort of try to not just tie together all the things he's announced in the summer, but sort of set out his direction for the country again and talk about public control, cost of living, putting power into the hands of communities. I think that that's all quite important for him. But it's also just a really interesting day for political journalists because we haven't actually seen him with his MPs yet. And it's not just what happens in the chamber, how he approaches Kemi Badenoch, but actually just a sort of the feel of things with his MPs. We haven't seen the sort of the mood or how things have settled after the reshuffle because it's been the summer holidays. And so actually getting a sense of what it's going to be like for him to govern. I think we're going to get the first big sense of that today.
Fraser, Kemi Badenoch was perceived, I think, in certainly in the latter months, as pretty effective against Keir Starmer. Does she have, as far as you know, a line of attack thought out for Andy Burnham, or do you think she'll have to wait and see how he performs?
I think both of them will have to improvise. I mean, she ended up being quite an effective foil against Keir Starmer, contrasting her vivacious style with his kind of lawyerly and bureaucratic vibe. She knows she's up against Andy Burnham, who she's really dismissing him as a man of eyelashes and a dark t-shirt, somebody who is far more charismatic, who projects himself on social media quite a lot. She wants to use that as a weapon against him, saying he can't really deliver when it matters. So I think both of them will be testing each other's defences, as it were, and trying to find where that kind of attack lines are going to lie on both sides.
Alva, some of the papers see the reshuffle Kemi Badenoch's just carried out as a prepping for an early election. Do you think that is fighting talk or just talk?
Oh, I think that that's a sensible way of reading it. I mean, right. I would be preparing for an election if I were Kemi Badenoch or any opposition leader, not necessarily in the coming weeks, but you can see the case for if the polls are looking okay for Andy Burnham sometime next year, maybe around May, first half of next year, you can see the case for him deciding to go to the country and try to secure his own mandate. So it makes sense for her to be ready for that. And also, I guess, to kind of put her own stamp on her team, her shadow cabinet, because when she became Tory leader, she kind of had to appoint a few big beasts from the last government, people like Priti Patel and Mel Stride. Yeah. Now she's got a bit, you know, she has a bit more experience. She can appoint people who are loyal to her, who have a bit less baggage from the last government and sort of have a fresher start.
Okay. Fraser, how do you read the reshuffle?
This is Kemi Badenoch putting a personal stamp on the party. And when she became leader, she had to keep various tribes happy. Now she's choosing people she thinks will have energy and also people who know what they believe. This isn't a left to right thing. This is more her choosing people who weren't the same people as were in the last Conservative government and who are driven by principles. But she realises, though, that her rating is quite high. Her party's rating is nowhere near that. And it's pretty much dropping along at 22%, that needs to change, and she's given this team the task of changing it.
Alva, how important is today, and how important are the conferences? Briefly.
Oh, I think that Andy Burnham has always said that his conference speech is going to be a huge moment. Right. So, yeah, that will be really big.